Eternal
and welcome to episode 3 of the Carpcast Extra, the monthly edition, which is packed full of stories. And we've got a few stories today, but first we say hello to Mark. How are we doing, pal?
I'm still dying of Ebola, but I'm loving it. Carpcast Extra 3, ready to go, and we all love a good carpy story.
Yeah, we certainly do. So we've got an in-session feature this time. As usual, I had a pretty interesting session on the infamous and famous Kevin Nash's Copse Lake. Managed to blag myself a second session down there. Not really sure how I did it, but I managed to do just before all the bidding starts, and you know, it's open to the general public. Hoping I might be able to squeeze myself back on there maybe next winter again, or certainly look at taking donations. I think we should start a Carpcast donation fund for Jamie and Mark to go and do a session on the Copse Lake or the church. I'm happy fishing either. Both fantastic lakes. What do you reckon?
Send Mark and Jamie to the Copse. Please give generously. Yes. There's got a certain ring to it.
Yeah. Yes, you can donate. yeah, it's all good. But I'll tell you what, before we get stuck into any questions, let's check in with me. Don't ask me how I've wangled it, but I've managed to get myself another session on Kevin Nash's Copse Lake, the infamous Copse Lake. Last time I came here, I had a 50 within about 10 minutes of the first rod being out. Well, the second rod it was, actually. But 10 minutes after putting it out. I've gone back in the same peg. The wind's blowing in my face. To give a bit of an update, it's the first week in March. And the lake's not been fishery, but has been extremely cold for the last 7 days. Like minus threes, minus fours. The lake hasn't frozen, but that's because they generally keep the water moving. Their pumps, the aerators and stuff, like pretty heavy duty ones in all the lakes on this little complex, which is good because I think it keeps the fish moving in winter. I've caught on the church in the depths of winter when it's been really cold. But it's new moon week this week, and there is a little bit of lower pressure, and it looks quite carpy at the minute. It's overcast, like I said, the water's very cold still, but the weather is warming up. I think it's going to be double figures by the weekend. It's currently Tuesday, and I've got till Friday. I'm not fishing Wednesday night because I'm having a drink and some food with Kevin. I might get the rods out really late if we're not too drunk, but I'm basically going to miss kind of like the evening period, certainly. Kevin says that this is a day water, but this time of year, pretty much all my activity's been at night. I had two bites at night last time I was on here, although I did catch the 50 in the afternoon, but that was exceptional conditions, very mild, warm wind blowing, you know, straight onto the area where I caught from. But I've had a walk around the lake, it's only a small lake, so I had a good lead around, all the way around, in an area that I've not fished before, near the island. Found a nice little drop, bit of depth, and it's really hard gravel, kind of off the island, like it's very sexy, sort of bumped down with lead. And on like the second or third cast, 100% sure I landed on a fish. 100%, can you be 100% sure? I'm 100% sure it was a fish. I was thinking it could be could have landed on a tree stump or something, but you know, these lakes were hand built. There's no tree stumps down there. it was definitely, it bumped on something and then bumped again as it hit the bottom. And the fish, I'm sure it was a fish, and it was quite low to the ground, which is usually a good sign. When you bump and they're like high in the surface, you know, it's I mean, it's not super deep, like it's probably 6-7 foot where I'm talking about, but I'd rather bump them in the bottom third than the top third. I've usually had bites when I've bumped off a fish in the bottom third, so I'm really confident about that rod. I popped it straight out on a fake maggot rig, a bit of fake corn, some fake maggot, and quite a few pouchfuls of maggots around it. I didn't bring any maggot last time. I wasn't as prepared for the session last time as I am this time, because I think it was like was it a bank holiday weekend or something. I couldn't get to the tackle shop. There's some reason why I couldn't, but this time I've boiled up a load of hemp. I basically used straight boilies last time, which these fish have been fed on boilies all their life, so it's not a problem using boilies, but I do like maggot and hemp in the winter. So I've got a mixture of both. I've got four rods out, spread all around. You know, I'm covering probably 60-70% of the lake where I am. And they're all, we've got rods all in little nooks and crannies. So I'm feeling happy. You know, I'm pretty sure I bumped a fish. Like I say, I mean, there's, I don't know how many fish are in here now. Depends how many have spawned and bred on in here. I know there's a lot of 20s and 30s that have spawned. I think the original stock was about 20 fish. You know, maybe there's 30, 40 with the stockies. They've been taking them out as they've been getting caught, the 20s. But there's definitely still a few in here, because I had two bites from them last time, as well as the big one. But so you're never that far from fish. I think it's just a tricky water whether they want to feed or not, which is why I've gone with the maggot. So it's the first night of three. As I said, I'm not going to fish most of tomorrow night, but I'm excited, very, very excited. We know what's in here. There's a fish called the wood carving, which is a common that must be 4 foot long, maybe a bit longer. I've seen them in the water in previous years in the summer. There's that one and the emperor that are very long commons, and the emperor is the one Kevin had on the front of his original catalogue years and years ago. It's a picture of him in the water with a very long common. That's the emperor, and the other one's even bigger. So I mean, they're both mid 50s and better, and the wood carving was actually out of 59 last time it was caught. So just a little beep on the R3. I like this pulsing light after you get a bee, like the latching light pulses. I quite like that. But it was a little gust of wind rather than anything exciting, that one. But got 2 or 3 days, and anything can happen. The weather's getting better as the week goes on. It's getting milder. We're on a new moon period. I'm in a smallish lake that's got a lot of big fish, and I don't want to bock myself, but I would be disappointed if I go home without a bite. If I had to bet money on bite or no bite over the next 3 days, it would probably be on bite. So fingers crossed we have some more news.
So we'll check back in with me in a short while, see how the session panned out. Right now we're going to welcome all our guests. We've got Alan Blair, Kevin Nash, Daryl Peck, Frank Warwick, John Mack, and Ronnie DeGrota. What do you fancy asking them today, Mark?
You know what, I think we should find out how they've come a cropper on the bank when they've managed to injure themselves. You know, that's something that just about everybody can relate to from at one time or another.
Yes, certainly. We've all got stories for that. I know I have. What about the other one?
Let's go the other end of the scale. Let's about their red letter days when, you know, when it all came right. And we know they've all got those. That's why they're in the positions they are.
Certainly, yeah. It's nice when you have those kind of red letter days as they are. It's good when it comes really, really right, and you just get them sessions where you know it's like almost like a bite of chuck, isn't it? You think of the last time that happened to you?
I do, last year.
Yeah.
I'd I think we've already spoke about this on the regular Carpcast, but I'll talk about it again because I enjoyed it. But I drove down to my big pit. I knew the swim I wanted to get in. Couldn't get in there for my first night because it was full of drunken students skinny dipping.
Nice.
So, set up at the opposite side of the lake. So, still in with a shout, but a swim where I could keep an eye on the swim I wanted. So, I got set up, got the binoculars out. All the skinny dippers were male, so I put them away. Didn't catch anything that night. Moved around the next day. Got everything sorted and it went well. Well, getting things out, I mean, bait up. The leads landed with a nice donk. And the feature I was fishing to, it was one of the very few weed beds in the lake last year. You know, the sailing club have dyed the lake because the Canadian pond was just choking the lake and ruining the meetings. So when you get a big pit where there's very little weed, you find a big weed bed, the carp ain't going to be far behind. So the night passed uneventfully. You know, woke up in the morning and it wasn't long before I got my first bite, which was, I believe, a 22-pound mirror. And I was just happy to save a blank, to be honest. But I put that one back, did some quick self-takes and a bit of video. It wasn't long before I was away again. That was a 22 common. But before I'd even netted that common, another rod was away. Ended up with a 31 mirror in the net with it at the same time. Mm. And then did the do with those. Did the self-takes, a bit more video. As I was returning the 30, I got another take. And another fish. Yeah, my memory does fail me a bit. I think that was like another low 20. Anyway, I ended up with 6 fish in about 2.5 hours that morning. Wow. From a session which ended up me fishing the wrong side of the lake because of avoiding a student's party. I think I might just join them next time. Just fish it anyway and be the strange old guy.
Yeah, the weird old guy at the rave. There's always one of those guys.
Oh yeah, it's same at bloody, well, I say it's same at rock gigs. I'm one of them now.
The last red letter day I had was the one that's in the in session on Carpcast 1. It was like a 24-hour period where I had like 10-11 bites, you know, just expecting it to go every time you put it out. So obviously we've spoke about that one. I can't really think of the last time where I was really having it off. I mean, probably on Wire Lake. I think I may have told this story as well, but I baited up fairly heavily in March because I was dropping the ticket. It was the year I had a red letter year that year. I think it was I'd single scale out of the car park. I think I had the Colmere fish. I fished King George's in Manchester, Altrincham, in January, breaking the ice, and had like 7 fish in a night. And I just had one of them years. It set me up for a good year. But part of it was I planned to do one session on the wire before the ticket ran out in March, because I was going to go and fish. I was going to go and fish Elstow, that's right. It was that year where we went on Elstow 2. That's right. And then the ticket was running out, so I wanted to make the most of it. I decided to do a bit of a baiting campaign where I knew that the fish woke up. And the plan actually changed. I'm sure I've told this story before, so I'm not going to go into too much sort of itty-bitty detail. But I basically saw some fish through binoculars, like breaking the surface in an area where they were sunning themselves in shallow water, where they don't normally get caught early in the year, kind of early March, you know, when you get in like the cold 0 degree nights and light frost, but you're getting them sunny, high-pressure days. Anyway, I saw a group of fish there and decided to move my plan away from the place where that normally does the first few bites of the year, like long range at the island. This other peg was going to give me like a nice 80 yard kind of spot so that I could get some bait in much easier than putting 10 boilies at a time in a rocket going 130 yards, which was the original plan. And and it worked tremendously. I put a full bucket out, like 15 to 20 key of like mixed hemp boilie. It's my first ever year on the Scopex squid as well. And I think I put 2 buckets out, 15 key, a day apart. I went down there, set up for the night, like after work at like 3 a.m, spotted at 11 for like an hour and a half, 2 hours, and was home by 1. And I think everybody on the lake was like, what's he doing over there? Like he just put a load of bait in, and he must have had an emergency phone call and had to go. Anyway, so I came back 2 days later, did the same thing again, and then I came back to fish on the Sunday, I think, and I had 3 nights, and did the same thing, spotted the bucket out when I first got there, and it just went off for 48 hours. I got take after take, had like maybe 20 bites, sort of 16 fish, which on the wire, I mean, you could catch 30, 40 fish a year. There were people in history that had caught that many fish in a season, but the bulk of the anglers caught between 5 and 15 fish a season, I would say. But, you know, the people that were doing a lot of time and knew the lake really well were catching a lot more, but, you know, your average guy, and I had more than that in a session. It was just crazy. Every time I was putting it out, I was expecting it to go again. And it was pretty. I had none of the big ones. Don't mean anything big came out. They were the smaller ones, but I was on a pretty decent group of fish, sort of 18 to 25 pound, I think they were at the time. 15 years ago, they were well, 14 years ago. Quite nice fish. It was certainly a red letter day.
What surprises me about that tale?
What?
Well, you said people have watched you firing all that bait in, and did no one move in it, or think I'm going to have some of that soon as he's gone?
It wasn't, that's what I'm saying, it wasn't a peg that you would generally expect the fish to be in. It wasn't like the island swims, of which there were 4 or 5, were where the fish used to wake up, where there's no weed in the lake and they get caught by the islands. But what I obviously trained them, because they were in this 4 or 5 foot water, sunning themselves in the daytimes, and were going at night. But I gave them a big feed to kind of hold them there. You know, if you did catch the odd fish in that peg early in the year, you'd catch them in the day and they'd move into the deeper water at night.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it was interesting. I learned quite a bit from that little mission. Always fish the shallows in winter. I mean, that's something that I've come to the conclusion of on lots of different lakes over the years. But the fish are never far from the shallows when the water's cold, except for like that kind of autumn period where the deep water is really, you know, significantly warmer than the rest of the lake. You know, when it first starts to cool down.
Yeah, you know, I think it was back in episode 3 of the regular cast when Rob Hughes was talking about thermal stratification, explaining exactly what it does for the educational.
Yeah, I've been talking about recently about that same thing. You know, when you're in the sea and you know, you go into those like warmer patches that for no reason just seem to be warmer as you swim through them. And colder, you know, you feel the same thing where you just get a cold patch. I forget who it was very recently. But enough of us yabbering on. Who do you fancy hearing about their red letter day first?
Ooh, who's that so good? I don't know. What do you reckon for Daryl? He's got a good choice of red letter days.
Let's get him on.
Right, my best ever session or best red letter day. Well, it's definitely a session rather than an individual day. And it would have to be the last 3 week session that I did in Belgium on a big public lake out there. I'd done a long session previous to the good one, and sort of hopped about, fished in a few different swims, and I left having caught 8 fish in 3 weeks, and 3 of them were over 55, which was great. But on the way home, I remember thinking, 8 fish in 3 weeks is not a good enough return. And from what I'd basically said, like answering one of these previous questions, like I'd seen the fish localising from in the summer months, so coming in short, coming into the edges, and I was fishing highly mobile off the wheelbarrow, and on the long session they just started to compress out into the middle of the open water and spending a lot of time at long range, and I came back with a plan, was to basically get this central swim and to fish much further out than the locals or the regular anglers would, and I basically sat in a swim for 50, I think 17 nights it was, and I constantly pumped bait out there. Each day I'd put 3 to 4 kilos of bait out at 140 yards, and I push all three rods sort of a rod length apart at the same sort of 35 reps out. Each rod was 35 reps, fish them a rod length apart, spawned over them, and then over those 17 nights, I just smashed the living hell out of it. You know, if I wasn't happy with eight, you know, I had 30 takes, I had 27 fish, I had 450s, I equaled my personal best at 65.4, and then I beat it with a 67.12, and then I caught the biggest fish in the lake on the second from last night at 71.12. So, yeah, to catch 27 fish from a lake that only had, I think it was like rumoured to have like 120 carp in it, you know, that is a proper bashing session.
Wow, I'm surprised you didn't get your van torched there.
I think they were too sort of wide-eyed to the long-range fishing. Everyone seemed to be like so looking at my rods and reels and like studying them as if they were like God's gift to carp fishing, that they are more interested in and taking note of what was going on than actually burning me out.
What was it there? Was it a spot that you found, or did you just realise you just needed to be 10 yards further than everyone else with bait? Or
well, the lake was sort of like a kidney shape, if that makes sense. But the ends of the kidney were slightly thinner, with like a slightly thinner bit through the middle, and the fish were coming in close in one particular area around to the left of where I fished, and I was watching them jump there at night and quite often go back out to the middle. And although they weren't always in the middle, but they were always passing through that water to get to the bits of the lake where they were going, the short distances. They were out there more than anywhere else, and I'd seen these fish topping on that first 3 week session, topping and topping and topping out there. And I spoke to Danny Fairbrass, and he fished there 20 years ago when you were allowed to use boats and outboards. And he said, "There's a massive platter out there, man. If you can find this platter, you'll absolutely kill it out there." I'm telling you, and I was like, he's telling me that, I'm thinking I've seen them all out there, that's where I need to be. And I remember I got in the swim and I put my spod rod together with a 5 ounce lead and a like real thin floating braid and absolutely smashed it out there. And after a few hours of plumbing, I found the start of this plateau, and it was 165 yards. And I was like, I can't spawn that far. If the wind's blown sideways, I can't spawn at 165 yards. And the day that I found it, although I could have got some bait out that day, I was like, I don't really want to, for a long session, I don't want to put my eggs in that basket. I was like, as much as I want to be out there, I wanted to fish slick. I wanted to put loads of bait out once a morning. So I put like 30, 40 spawns out at 10 in the morning, recast them all, one cast each on the clip and be done. I didn't want to be struggling to hit the clip. So I carried on plumbing after finding this plateau, and I managed to find like a harder bit in the silt, sort of 20 yards back from the edge of this plateau. And it wasn't like I said, that plateau, the drops on that plateau were like biblical, you know, like Ian Bocum was down there with a bat smacking the lead back to me. And I knew if I was out there, I'd have been causing all sorts of damage. But as it went, you know, still fishing 20 yards back from that plateau, it was close enough. You know, they were out crossing that plateau, obviously, regularly. And I was fishing in the autumn, which is a good time to be in the slightly deeper water. So I was on the near edge of this plateau, just short of it. And, I think it was mainly the range. It was obviously quite hard as it was approaching this plateau. Not so smelly bottom compared to other areas in the lake. And it was just more the case that the fish passed my bait over that session. They passed my bait more than anyone else's. And as they were passing it, they become more and more tuned in to the fact that it would be there. And it was just the right time. But, you know, people catch over big hits of bait, and it doesn't always work for other people. And the real key to using loads of bait and sitting it out is timing and the positioning. And if you get the timing and the positioning right and the carp traffic over your rigs, then, you can lead sessions like that.
Belgium tales, yeah, I can't get enough of hearing how Daryl hammered that Belgium lake the other year.
That was a great story. If anyone's wants to see it, it was on the Masterclass DVD they did last year. And also, Daryl was good enough to do a slideshow for the Icombe Sailing Club in Lincoln for us a few weeks back. And, you know, half of this tale was on that Belgian adventure. And, wow, what a story it was. And those fish are just, well, epic. Doesn't quite cover them. They're absolutely stonking fish. Great massive commons. There's a great big orange thing. There's a mid-40 as well.
We got Daryl's scary story from the same venue as well, didn't he? Was it on the last Carpcast Extra where he felt very unsafe with some Eastern Europeans? Fortunately, that was a different peg where he just had that red letter day from. Same lake, different peg, but yeah, it's... has something happened to that lake now? Has it changed? Has some circumstances changed? Or fish died?
I've not heard anything. No. I'd like to.
Everyone was
like to know where it is.
Yeah, I don't think it's hard to find. I think you can get a ticket on it. I don't know how much they like English after they've been over there and pillaged it. But Danny Fairbrass fished it for a bit, didn't he? And then Daryl obviously hammered it. But I'm sure there was everybody wanted to fish it after that time, and then I don't hear anybody talking about it anymore. I'm not sure if something...
I don't know.
The circumstances...
Probably put a publicity ban on it.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. Well, let's move a little more local to home. We've got Kevin Nash, and his red letter day was somewhere in his home county, the Essex Manor, I believe. A session that really sticks out, a red letter day, either a load of carp or just a plan that came together. What do you think was...
Well, for me, yes, obviously I've had some big hits, but it will be a plan that's come together. Yeah, I've always said that when that indicator rises, it's job done, and I don't want a carp to fight too hard. That's where all the work went into, setting the trap and getting the result. And ooh, the one that comes to mind is my first capture of the Manor Biggin. I arrived to do my fifth night. This is when I was really on it. I'd been doing, spent the winter on Star Lane, really tuning all my rigs and finding methods, because I knew I was hitting the Manor and then Warmwell, and I was so on it and so believed in everything I was doing. This is when I'd hit on sharpening my hooks, getting a diamond jeweller to sharpen. Anyway, I turned up, spotted a fish roll from a great distance, went round and realised, well, I hope this is where it was. Put my three rods out. Just as I got the third rod out, a big fish has rolled 30 or whatever yards up the bank. So I've wound all the rods in, gone up there, got two out, just casting the third out, and it rolled further up the bank. I couldn't cast it because there was a reed bed in the way. So from memory, I think I baited three spots, kept spacing them up the lake, and I went back up on the bank and sat there watching. And it was lucky, it was really windy. I just happened to be looking at the exact spot where I put the furthest bait, and I just saw the water flatten. So I moved my gear up there, put the three rods out, and after 15 minutes I got a single bleep. And it didn't develop, and I just couldn't deal with that. So I was so on it, about my rigs, and I just believed totally something was wrong. Spooked the carp or whatever, I'm on it. So I wound my rig in, checked the hook, it seemed just as sharp, but it's one of them, it can be just so subtle. So I changed the rig, put it back out, 2 minutes later it roared off, and so that was a Manor Biggin over 40.
Wow.
Just and that's why I say, because I was hunted it, believed totally in the approach and was so focused, all that work I've been putting in on developing rigs, and that was
did you know you were going to catch it that day? Did it feel like today's the day, I'm on its tail?
To be honest, I hadn't even thought of the fish. It was so rare, it was all about the Annie, and I wasn't there to catch the Annie because Gary was after that. I was just going to catch the rest of the margies, but there was never any conviction that I wasn't going to catch that fish. I wasn't thinking what it is. In fact, it was a major shock when it turned out to be the big one. In fact, I nearly put it back without telling Gary, because I was so obsessed that I'd caught it before he caught the amphibian. It's only because my missus rang me, and I said, "Oh, he's going to be." I'm going to put it back, and then when he's caught the Annie, I'll show him the picture. He said, "What are you doing?" He'd go mad if he knew you kept it for him. Then I'd come to my senses. But to answer you, there was never any other than self belief.
There's never a doubt you weren't going to catch it.
Never a doubt, whatever that fish was, I was going to catch it.
Yeah. Yeah, I only ever managed a guest session on the Manor. Shame the amphibian's gone now. Would have liked to have had a go for that one at one time or another, but still loads of big fish in there. But I don't know, something about the place, it's not sure if I'll ever get to fish it. But one place I did fish in Essex was Kevin Nash's Copslate. Let's check back in there.
So it's 9:15 in the evening. It's been dark a few hours. Only time the alarm sprung into life. One of the rods that's just round the corner, slightly out of my peg, just had a few series of quick beeps on it and then dropped back a little bit. Couldn't see what did it. It seemed a bit fast to be a liner. It could have been a bird picking it up. It's hard to tell in the dark. I'd like to think it was a liner. All the rods are fairly close range, so I mean, you would expect it to move fairly quickly if it was a liner. It would be nice to pick up a few liners just to let me know the fish are moving around pretty happily. I mean, it is March. I know it's been super cold the last week. Well, just found a little critter that's you know, a bit of spring life, like one of them jelly caterpillar crawly things. Just found one of them on top of my pan lid, so that's obviously come out of the water, so things are waking up. And I'm just hoping that the you know, the longer days, the light levels are kind of overriding the water temperature, just letting them know that winter's finished. But yeah, I hope they're moving around. Like I say, I'm confident that I did bump off a fish on the right hand rod near the island, so apprehensive. We're going to be trying hard. We're on limited time. One of the last times I'll ever get to fish this lake, probably. So we need to make it count. It's about 5 a.m. It's maybe 5:30. Just starting to get light. Woke up by an absolute screamer. Just ripped this fish. It's a rod that's straight out in front of me. It's only like 6 wraps straight out in front. Absolutely melted off. Landed it with pretty much no drama. And then it's one of the commons that's obviously bred in here. Looks 20 pounds something. Not very big, but really weird fight. Just didn't know it was hooked. Probably, clearly, fish that's never been caught before, because it wouldn't be in here if it had already been caught. It would have been taken out. Which is probably what's going to happen to it now. So I'm going to get it in the sling. Weigh it up, have a look how big it is. It's chucking it down with rain. It's really moody, actually. It's overcast, raining, blustery, pretty damn carpy, actually. I'm glad something's moving. What a good sign that is. Let's get it sorted and get the rods back out.
Yeah, what a lake. What a lake that is. Should we go over to our favourite Belgium?
I think we should. Let's see what Ronnie's red letter day was.
Yeah, come on, Ronnie.
Yeah, a red letter days. What can I say about that? If you fish a long time, you certainly will have a couple of days that will always pop up, more than others. But for me personally, my best day fishing, I think, of course, that record carp, and I also caught a mirror common record in Belgium also. These are two red letter days also. But if I just look at one day and number of catches and enjoying myself, unbelievable, then I have to go back to the 2nd of November in 2013. And that was my 49th birthday. And that was on the Singo River in Brazil. Normally the Amazon is, let's say, a big canal between in a forest. It's a green wall on the left side, a green wall on the right side, and you have a forest, and that's the forest, and you have a big canal, a big river. But the Singo River is, I think, in my opinion, it must be one of the most beautiful rivers in the Amazon area. an area with a lot of lava, so vulcan area, a lot of there must have been a lot of vulcans in the past there, a lot of lava, a lot of white water, you know, well, very beautiful. Anyway, I went fishing there in October, November 2013, and my main target were peacock basses. I like peacock basses, you know. They are very beautiful. They are very aggressive. You can catch them on top water lures. And, of course, they are payaras, the Dracula fish. They are lalaos, red tails, just name it. But for me, peacock bass, nevertheless, they are only up to about 7 kilos. The butterfly peacock gland, they grow to up to about 7, 8 kilos. They are my favorite. And I was the only, at that day, I was the only guest in the lots. All my friends had already gone home for one day. So my plane was 2 days later to fly back to Germany and then from Germany to Belgium. So I had one day extra at my disposal, and I was out with an Indian fishing guide. His name was Mona Says. Great guy, 60 years old. Portuguese was the only language that he spoke, but nevertheless, we understood each other, you know, without a lot of words. Sometimes you have it with people, you know, it match that well, you know. You look in each other's eyes, you straight away, okay, we're going to do this, going to do that. It matched perfectly. So and we were fishing the Singu River downstream of the lots. And at one particular moment, I took a propeller bait out of my bait box, and it was an imitation of a frog. And Mona Saves looked at it, and he started laughing. And I said, "Is this the first time you see it?" He said, "Yeah, I've never seen a propeller bait like this." And I saw in his eyes that it was like what kind of bullshit is going to, that kind of. So I made a cast, nothing. Made the second cast, I had a follower. Made a third cast, I caught a peacock bass, and straight away, from that moment on, every cast that I made, he was following it, every inch that it was on the water, and his head was going from left to right, and so on. So I caught a couple of very nice peacock bass on it, and then, we both had the feeling, okay, this one particular spot, we will not have any action from it anymore. So we go to the other side and of the river, which was about, I think, 80 meters wide or something like that. It was a little bit downstream, and that was the beginning of a back bay. And I made the cast to one of the points from the entrance. And straight away, I got a take, and it was a bicuda. Do you know what a bicuda is? Okay. Now, a bicuda is a freshwater barracuda. So they do not grow that big as barracuda. So barracudas can grow, more or less up to 2 meters or something like that. But bicuda grow to about, let's say, 1.20 meters. The head is a little bit smaller, but they are very familiar, like a barracuda, like something like the middle between a barracuda and a pike. And believe it or not, it was one of these big ones. It was estimated, I think, at least 1.10 meters. I don't know, body from belly to the back, I think 20, 25 centimeters, really a proper specimen. Of course, it tail walked, and it managed to lose my propeller braid. So yeah, that was pity, but that's nevertheless, you know, it would become still my best day fishing ever. But I really if I had caught that, then it was not a red letter day, then it was a cold letter day, that's for sure. Anyway, we continue fishing. In the meantime, I caught peacock bass up to about 5.5 kilos, which is big for the butterfly peacock, as their maximum weight is about more or less 7 kilos. They are a couple of bigger specimen of the peacock bass, but they are living more north in the area from Manaus to the Colombian Venezuelan border in that area, so the river Rio Negro. But at the Singo, the butterfly peacock bass, about 5.5 kilos are big. So we were catching left and right, you know. Certain moment, I have to say, at that moment also, so the end of October, early November, it's raining season, so the water starts to rise, and it can really rise a lot. The difference between low water and high water can easily, between 12 and 15 meters over there. So, and the water had already risen, I think, more or less 2 meters. So also the peacock bass, they started to move from the shallow water to, let's say, water of 3, 4, 5 meters deep. And if you want to catch them from 4 meters deep water on a stake bait, you really have to work hard. Normally, if they are in, let's say, 0.5 meter of water, you use a small stick bait, light spinning rod, let's say 40 grams, 9 foot 40 gram spinning rod, for example, that will do the business. And then you really work from your lure from in the wrist of your hand. But if they really are in deep water, I mean 3, 4, 5 meters, to bring them down to the surface, well, you need a bigger stake bait, you need a stronger rod. So, but luckily I had a 9 foot scope rod with me, and so I managed really with the bigger stake baits to pull one to the surface. And I think at maybe 7 meters from the boat, chin clear water, we saw a lot of lava blocks and so on. That water exploded, you know, and my lure was gone. Straight away, that scope rod in had a bend of 90 degrees, so that peacock bass dived straight between the lava blocks, and it cut my line. So I looked at Manassas, and I said, what's the biggest weight you have caught here this year? Or, you know, somebody has caught in a boat here with you this year. He said 7 kilos. And I said, and he shook his head from left to right, you know. So it could be one of these. So anyway, that's things that happens. But I caught so many of them that day, I think maybe 50. I got maybe 100 other followers and so on. I caught smaller bicudas. You know, that is a red letter day for me. I think I will never have a day fishing like that in my life, or at least not the first week. I'm not fishing next week. Well, yeah, that is certainly is something, you know, really, yeah, this is exceptional, because it's, you can catch, let's say, 50 to 100 peacock bass a day if you really have the right swim and the right circumstances, but the circumstances were not really that good anymore because of the rising water, so that made it more difficult. So we lose quite a lot of time finding them. At one particular moment, we found them in a bit of a backwater, and they were around submerged rock, and there I caught, I don't know, maybe 25 of them just from that one single rock. But yeah, it's everything. It's the picture, the place where you are, the people where you are with. You know, Mona says, a guy an Indian who does only speak Portuguese. I can help myself in Spanish. I'm therefore I do understand a little bit of Portuguese, but certainly not fluently. Yeah, but you are on one line with that guy, right area, right moment, right action. That is certainly a red letter day, so without any doubt.
Hope you don't mind a non-carp red letter day, but I just love Ronnie's stories. And would you like to go out to the Amazon, Mark?
Oh, without a doubt. Although I think I'd want some good bug spray.
Yeah, it's scary. I forget, was it in Ronnie's main interview that he did on the normal Carpcast, where he spoke in depth about his foreign trips and telling you the stuff to be scared of and not scared of, if I remember. Yeah, it was pretty interesting, but generally he went into great detail about all the things that can kill you in various parts of the world, but there actually aren't many that you've got to be really scared of, like not many at all. So he doesn't get apprehensive about all the critters. But yeah, when you think of going into the jungle, it's the first thing that crosses my mind is what's out there to get me.
Yeah, that's one good thing of living in Great Britain. You know, you might get stung by a wasp. It's a pain, but it irritates you. It's nothing more. You go like Australia. Now they tell you not to even walk in the woods unless you know what you're doing. You know, there's snakes and spiders and honey badgers. they're vicious.
Let's move across to a geezer who don't imagine being scared of anything. Mr. Johnny Mac.
Yeah. So I think one of my most prolific successful sessions, or like a red letter day or whatever you want to call it, it probably wasn't when I caught any massive fish, but it was a cold time of year. I mean, I love my winter fishing. It was October or something like that. Not full on winter, but it was cold. And it was down at Nutsy, down near the south coast there, down towards Southampton. And I was at after the Nutsy Mirror at the time. And what happened, I never, ever used chod rigs. I climbed up a tree, I could see a fish, and it swam around this weed bed, and it picked up something off the side of this weed. And it was like Canadian, but it had silkweed growing around it and on it and all that, you know. And they were sort of, it moved off, then another one came round, and it done exactly the same thing. And I thought, there's no way I could put a bait there unless I have a chod rig. So, I don't like lead core, so I just decided to use a naked chod. And I put a chod rig on, I tied it up, cast it out. And yeah, it wasn't long before I had one on, sort of thing. And there was a few really old classic fish in there, some absolute stunning dark jet black fully scales. There was a lovely old leany called the strawberry in there, which was like almost reddish, you know, tinge to it. And that strawberry was one that I really nearly wanted to catch. And yeah, just kept going and flicking them out. It's only, you know, 20, 25 yards, that sort of range. And I think I ended up with about 8 fish that trip. And one of them was the strawberry. And I'd gone from catching one fish every now and then, and I had 8 in a session. It was just absolutely crazy. So I haven't had many red letter days.
There's no better feeling than when you're on fish like that. You've got a method, and every time you put it out, you're just almost watching the bobbin like you used to do when you were a kid, because you know you're going to catch another, then another, then another. You know, there's no better feeling in fishing than that, because it happens very rarely, doesn't it?
You're right, it happens rarely, and I haven't had many days like that. But yeah, don't get me wrong, I've had some phenomenal braces. But red letter days, most successful, like, you know, lots of fish in a session. There weren't no big fish in there, but like that strawberry, by the way, was one of them, and I think it was 26-27 pound. But what a fish, great it was.
Our next story is from Alan Blair, and something that's very topical at the minute is his session on Lake Bled, where he found the film. I don't know if have you watched it all yet, Mark?
I've watched all the Eurobanks, which is what this is about. And well, I put it on, honestly, mate, while I was potting around doing other bits and bobs, and I got absolutely nothing done. You know, I got sucked in. It was a great film, and, you know, a proper red letter day as well. You know, that lake is just awesome.
Yeah, it's fantastic. We don't know what we're talking about. Watch Euro Banks, which is on the new Nash free DVD, or I don't think it's DVD yet. You can just watch it on YouTube, Nash TV. But it was a red letter session like probably no other. Let's let Alan tell you the story.
Red letter sessions, for sure, in my lifetime there's been loads of sessions that stand out, has been special for many, many reasons. But in more recent times, I think the one I'd recount is when we went and filmed Eurobanks 2. We'd done, I don't know, 1,500 miles across four or five different countries, and eventually found ourselves in Slovenia fishing Lake Bled. And bar the fact that I was in great company, you know, in beautiful environments, and the weather was great, the fishing was also exceptional. However, the windows for the fishing were very, very short. For example, we could catch early in the morning or late in the evening. We were only there for 3 days, and on the second from last day, myself and a good friend, Bastille, we went off in search of these carp. And, you know, what we learnt very, very quickly after spending only a short amount of time there was go and find them. Because if you could find them, you could catch almost instantly. You know, they know what boilies are. They were hungry fish. You just had to get on top of them. Anyway, the day had been ridiculously hot. We'd caught nothing between the four of us all day. And it was approaching that time in the evening where it's time to go and find them. So off we set, right round to where there was a big beach. There was hundreds of lads and girls swimming and sunbathing and generally having a laugh, you know, on this beach. And I walked up a little bit further. And to be honest, at the time, Bastard was a little bit despondent. You know, we were both exhausted and shattered, and to the point where if we maybe hadn't have found some fish within the next sort of half an hour, we would have probably called it a day, gone and got some sleep ready for the morning sort of hit. But I wandered off through some undergrowth, and lo and behold, I walked down to a huge fallen tree into this sort of bay area and started to see carp. Now, not 5 carp or 15 carp, like 50 carp, all swimming around my feet in 2.5 foot of water, and there were some good fish there. I've gone back to see Bastille, and he was ready, I suppose, for me to turn around and say, nah, I haven't seen anything, mate, but actually, they were stacked up in there. We rushed back, we got the gear, and we made our way back into this area where the fish were. Now, not really knowing what to expect on such a varied water, we kind of took short bank sticks with us. So the first stumbling block was the area we wanted to fish. We needed to put our rods right out in the lake to get a line angle to get up to this sort of large snaggy area where the fish were holding up. Really, we should have had 48 inch sticks, put the bank sticks on it, rods out in the water. So we didn't. We had little 12 inch bank sticks, really undergunned for the situation. So I proceeded to wade out into the lake and tape and tie with 20 pound armour braid my bite alarms onto trees. So I'd finally mounted some bite alarms on trees. We then went and started baiting, and we were literally throwing this food in, and the fish were taking it on the drop. Give them a bit of food, let them get their heads down, quickly went round there. And in the space of approximately 2-3 hours, we landed 18 fish, probably lost 6-8, biggest 50 odd pound, numerous 40s, loads of upper 30s, and that was literally fishing two rods. As soon as we cast a rod out, one would go off. We ran out of landing nets, we ran out of retainer slings, we ran out of sacks. In the end, we had to ring Ollie and Nick to come round and give us some backup, but it was an absolute red letter session. It was in the middle of an electrical thunderstorm. There was lightning bolts coming down everywhere, and it was just one of those moments in angling where you couldn't put a foot wrong. Everything fell into place. The fish moved up from a very, very deep area of water onto a big sandy plateau, and we just set to and caught as many as we possibly could. It was amazing.
Was it all on film?
All of it.
Oh.
Check it out. You know, but I don't know when you guys have heard this, but it'll be on YouTube, Eurobanks 2. Check out the bit of Slovenia when all hell broke loose and we just carnage.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, you definitely might see me there at some point this year. If not this year, then next year. It looked fantastic, and I don't know. It was one of them things where it dropped right. I mean, that session, you'll see it more if you watch the video, but it epitomises a red letter day, I think. They found the fish, got take straight away as soon as they put it out, and they just, you know, couldn't keep the rods in the water. It just kept going, you know, chunk after chunk. You just want it, when you have a red letter session like that, you want to finish up with the one to really make it, don't you? One. Like, it's great.
Showing on top.
Yeah, once you've caught a load of fish, you want that one. You know, you want the biggest in the lake, or the, you know, the most desirable one, or whatever. I remember, you know, my red letter day that we told on the first Carpcast Extra, on the Secret Lake, as we called it, the in session feature. Like, we just wanted a real big one to top it off. I mean, I had a couple of 30s and I had a lot of 20s, but you know, just to bang a 40 out or something would have been like the absolute dream scenario. Quite often when you're having it off like that on the lake, like, you do normally end up, don't you, with one of the special ones.
You do, yeah. Often the well, if you get a shoal of fish, your averages says that at least, you know, one or two of them out there are going to be the chunks, and chunks are chunks because they eat a lot.
I remember my second ever session on Nashie's Church Lake, which was quite a lot of years ago now, maybe like eight years ago or something. I got the first session on there, had a few fish. I don't think I fished it as well. I didn't really know what to expect the first time, and like, it hadn't been fished loads the first time I fished it, and the fish used to get scared when you caught one, so I ended up having a few bites. I ended up losing a couple. Had nothing spectacular. I think I had like a low 30 and a 26 and lost like three or four fish. Just wasn't really equipped for the session. I got a chance to go back maybe the following year. It had been fished quite a bit more then. And I set up one end. You know, I'd learned a lot more about the lake then. I was really, really excited about it. Got on anyway. I started catching straight away. I ended up having six fish in a day, or just over, like one after the other. In the daytime on a hot day, it was like June or something, and they were all 20s. To catch six fish in a row, like on a lake like that, that, you know, it's got a lot of 30s and 40s in it at the time, and it had a couple of 50s. It was almost disappointing, even though I was having it off and catching fish. It was just like, I just need a big one. I was on the group of fish in one corner. To cut a long story short, I ended up having the big common, which has been 50. I had it at 48, and I lost. The one Keith Jones had. It was the biggest fish in there for quite a lot of time. I told the story in the one that got away last week, last Carpcast Extra, actually, where it was stuck in the reeds. And I couldn't get the net in, you know, to get it out.
Oh, I remember that. So was it the Decade or the Power Station or something?
That's
like that?
That's it, yeah, the Power Station. It'd been like a mid-50. It was the late record at 54. I think it was, don't think it was 50 around then. I think it was less than 50. Because it was definitely after spawning, because the common was 48 and it was normally like 51, 52. But yeah, I mean, I did get that big one to finish off all those bites. Like I said, I had quite a few fish that session. And it was just like, once you've got over the fact that your bobbins keep going and you're having a really good session, after that, like, you just want the big one, don't you?
You do. I know, on the Red Letter Day, I mentioned earlier on the big pit. I mean, not as big as those. Yeah, I was catching 20s, and then, there's a 31 popped up in the middle. Yeah, I was quite pleased with that, especially seeing the net with another one at the same time, although two in the net together weighed about as much as what you've been catching recently.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can only catch what's in front of you, but there's a lot of lakes with a lot of big fish around now. I know you're kind of up for that sort of fishing this year, isn't it? It's, you know, you can take the easy choices. You can pick a nice, moderately difficult lake and make life hard for yourself. But there's so many lakes with like big 30s, 40s, and even the odd 50 knocking about now. There's so many that we've got access to that. Why not just fish for them? You know, at the end of it, be holding a big 40 up or something.
What about the ones that we've not got access to? They're the ones you fish.
Yeah, I mean, if they live there and it's fishable, then you might find me fishing them.
Not if you're doing it right.
maybe. Let's finish off the Red Letter Day with another great storyteller, Mr. Frank Warwick.
My best ever session that stands out in mind, I've had loads. I think one of them was where I'd alluded to it earlier, where I altered the buoyancy of the bait when I went on Reedsmere on the opening day. I'd planned all this, and it was about, I think it was about 1983. And what I'd done is I'd messed around with the buoyancy of the baits, but also I'd done a lot of research. And do you know when you, I always find that when I do planning and really plan to the every detail, that I fish much better rather than just grabbing the gear and taking off and grabbing a few baits out of the fridge. When I plan and scheme, it all comes together. Yeah. And what I've done, right, I'll tell you about this. It's interesting. There's a story to it. My uncle used to be second in command on the North West Water Authority, and he was a legal man, and he used to take people to court, that big companies, the corporate people that had not paid bills and this, that and the other. And he rung me up and he says, hey, he says, got an interesting one at the moment. He says, we've had a lot of poaching in Cumbria on the salmon rivers and that. And he says, we've got some guys that have been actually using firearms, threatening bailiffs when they've tried to challenge him. And they've been cyaniding the rivers, taking all these salmon, and they've been doing other stuff. And he says, and we've got the police involved and a special unit, and we've arrested them. And he says, and we've got some of them, we've confiscated the gear, and it's we're using it in the evidence for the court case. And I said, oh, I. He says, yeah, we've got some of them Russian night sights. It's like a pair of goggles that you wear. And I said, oh, bloody hell. At the time, imagine that, in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I says, when the court case is finished, to my Uncle Jim, I says, can I have them Russian night sights? Because obviously I want to do fish spotting in the dark and everything.
Yeah.
He went, no. Oh, they're all accounted for. He says, they're part of the evidence. You can't have them. He says, but I wasn't ringing about that. He said, it's the other stuff that we've confiscated that you might be interested in. Because he knew he was mad on fishing bait, you know.
Mm.
I says, what's that then? He says, there's this stuff that they've been putting in the river pools to attract the salmon and hold them in the area. And he said, it's a bit of a secret. He says, but we found out off one of these poachers, and one of the bailiffs knows about it, and they call it jamming. And I says, what the hell's that? He says, they're liquidising salmon eggs, and they're using the salmon eggs with this other compound to put in the pool, and it just keeps all the salmon in one area till they can net them or cyanide them.
Wow.
He says, we've got tons of these salmon eggs that have all been liquidised, and he said, it's like jam. There's massive jars of it. And he said, it's all in our fridges at work. And he says, we've got that as evidence, but when it's all done, we're going to throw it away, or do you want it? I said, no, I'll have it. I says, what is it again? So he told me what it was, but it was all liquidised salmon eggs. And I thought, right, I'm going to make my bait up, but instead of using chicken eggs, I'm going to use salmon eggs. Because it's still got albumin in it and that, but not as much as chicken eggs, but it's still got it in. But the smell was unbelievable. I got loads of this stuff, and I thought, oh, it looks fantastic. So I was using white baits at the time, and I'd worked with Duncan Kay, who sadly just died recently. He's a good old mate of mine. And what happened was, I was working at his bait factory and living at his house, and he says to me, is there anything you specifically want for making your own baits? Because he used to let me use all his ingredients and knock all my own baits up. And I said, yeah, I want to dye them white. And he goes, white? I says, yeah, white. And he went, I've never heard of that before. He says, no, there isn't any white dyes available. So he got all these reference books, and he said, look, I've traced this white here. This white dye, titanium oxide. He says, I can get it from a supplier in Germany. He says, shall I get you some? So he got me a kilo of it. I always remember it. So I got this white dye. So I made some baits up, and they were absolutely brilliant white. Bear in mind, no one in Britain or in Europe's got this white dye for the fishing trade, for bait. Mm. So I made up these white baits, and I tested them on Roman lakes in the close season, and I had 32 fish in a day.
Wow.
Couldn't keep the rods on the buzzers. Two rods going constantly all day. I thought, oh, what have I got here? Can you imagine it? I'm the only person on white baits in the world. So I got the white baits. So I'm waiting for opening day on the mirror. And then I'm messing around with the buoyancy, like I told you, microwaving them. Microwaving the baits so that they're all different buoyancies. And I made up the baits with salmon eggs. And I thought, oh, this is going to be an interesting test. So basically the baits came out a pink colour, because when I put the salmon eggs in, it changed the colour of them. So what I did, I left all the baits marinating and soaking in the liquidised salmon eggs, so they smelt incredible. And the baits, the flavour I was using them days was old Rod Hutchinson's coffee cream, sort of soaking them in this salmon egg juice, and it was in the baits anyhow, so I did a big baited area, and oh my God, it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. And I caught a season's worth in 24 hours, basically. And I had the biggest mirror in the lake as well. Second trip down, I had the male and the snub in a brace and lost the original linear at the net, but I had seven fish on that on the next trip down. Two fish at once on the first session, I think. It was 11 or 12 I had. And I had had the biggest mirror in the lake and a fish called Jurassic, which was another of the big linears in the, you know, heavily plated fish. So what a session that was. So that was everything came together, including the salmon eggs had a big part in it, though, Jamie, I'll tell you, because I had 37 fish up until the 1st of September. Then I ran out of the salmon eggs and the effect died. The bait wasn't as good without them salmon eggs in. So it's not more about the captures, it's more about how. I think that's very important. And then, I mean, salmon eggs, by the way, are illegal to use. I must stress that, you know. You can still get them, but it's very difficult. And
that was my next question. Can we still get salmon eggs?
Here's one for you. I used to roll bait at Trebs of Wimslow for people, right, the old fishing tackle shop there. And there was a bloke called Jeff who lived in Bedfordshire. He was a big customer of Trevor's. And he was in a syndicate with a few whackers in. I don't know what was the name of the place, but it was an exclusive syndicate with some 40s in and stuff. And he says, he came to me and he'd been having a bit of a poor time, you know, and he knew I'd been doing well. And he says, Frank, he says, can you help me with the bait? And I says, leave it to me. And he had a lot of money, this Jeff. I mean, he was a millionaire, you know. And I says, listen, I told him the story of the salmon eggs and how well it had gone. And he says, well, I'm going to do some research and see if I can get some salmon eggs. So, basically, he got onto Billingsgate Fish Market and sourced them at 40 quid a kilo.
Wow.
So I says, get 10 kilo, Jeff. Right? So he spent 400 quid on salmon eggs. I made him an absolute shitload of bait up. At the end of the season, I heard it was going well. He came down and he had a fistful of prints and he'd caught all the big fish in the lake. And I can't even tell you how many fish he'd got, and he'd had the biggest common and the biggest mirror out of the lake, and all the backup fish as well, all the A-team in the lake, he'd had everything.
Illegal or not, I think you're going to get about 5,000 people hunting salmon eggs down after this.
Yeah, well, you can use lumpfish eggs and trout eggs and stuff like that, but it's obtaining them that's the bugger. You know, it's very difficult, but it is a game changer. So, but that contributed to one of my most memorable days fishing ever in the UK, you know, and I just wish I could get them now. Having said that, Northern Baits, it's a Danish outfit that and Norwegian, they're friends of mine, and I told them about it, and they can get untold amounts from Norway. It's okay over there, and it's completely legal, so I should be dealing with that very shortly, that situation.
Sure, we'll edit this bit out.
Okay. Yeah, we can leave it in or out, whatever you want, Jane, you know, it doesn't matter, but it's interesting, isn't it? Feels like I'm in love. Said the first time I met you.
So, what month are we in now, Mark? We're all gearing up for a good season. The weather's starting to warm. It was 16 degrees. I was driving home from fishing today. It was 16 degrees. It's the middle of March when we're recording this. Is that right? Yeah. Two-thirds of the way through March, like the 20th or something, isn't it?
Yeah. We're in that stage at the minute where we've got, fairly high pressure. It has been, anyway. You know, bright sun, warm days, but you know, the temperature's still reaching down to freezing at night, so
yeah,
I think we need just that big warm wind to really churn the water up. That's what I like anyway, any time of year.
It's an interesting time of year, I think, because the sun does more good in the day than like the cold, clear nights are doing, I think. Just that, you know, the days are getting pretty long now. The clock's changed next week. Is it next week?
Yeah, I think we are that close. Wow, time flies.
Yeah, so it's a cracking zig time of year. I know you made New Year's resolutions as well, didn't you? You were making resolutions to pre-tie your rigs like Jules. How's that going?
Yeah, that was one of... I made several, actually, but I'm sticking to my others, which I'll just run through. My first one was not to waste any more money on gym memberships. And second one was not to smoke. And being a non-smoker, that one's so easy, it's unbelievable.
Had you actually joined the gym?
Not for about 10 years.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd make... Because no one keeps the New Year's resolutions, do they? So I thought I'll make two, which I'll have to do absolutely nothing, and I'll still keep them. Cheating, but...
And your third one about time rigs, did you keep that one?
Well... Yeah. I've always got a handful tied, you know, for what I need. You know, I will pop into the garage one evening after work and, you know, sort the kit out, get it ready, and if I need any rigs tying, I'll usually tie half a dozen or so. And then, you know, I'll fish the session and then just dump everything in a tackle box at the end and I'm back to square one. It's a mess. But, no, I am I'm actually, you know, trying to be a bit more prepared because, you know, when we speak to people like Jules and, you know, when before I spoke to Kev Hewitt, you know, I was doing some research, you know, well, stalking him, basically. You know, watch some of his, you know, YouTube videos, and he's got these, you know, solid bags pre-tied on rigs ready to just, after he's landed a fish, he just has to snip the leader off, tie another rig with a bag on, and it's out, you know, in no time at all. Which, you know, when you're fishing these busy day ticket gaffs and, you know, matches, it's, you know, time counts. And, yeah, to doing this carp cast, you know, meeting these people and talking to them, you certainly learn, and, yeah, getting, you know, preparation is something where, you know, I'm certainly, I'm trying harder, a lot harder than I have done for the past few years. Because I remember years back when I, you know, like Elstow days when I was mega keen, you know, everything was in order, everything was tidy, everything was tied up, ready to go. So, how about you? Are you a Boy Scout? Are you prepared?
Six rigs will last me about four or five sessions. I like to have like the ones on my rods and like two spare, just to interchange so that. You know, I always fish like with a, you know, a stick threaded onto the hook link and usually a blowback rig or whatever. And I like to have like two sticks kind of made up for the recast, or maybe one for each rod. So if I'm using three rods, I'll have three on the rod and three spare. And those six rigs will probably do me about three or four sessions, just alternating them, because I always touch the hook up. I'll always sharpen it. So, the three that are off the rod, I put the three fresh ones on with the bags, you know, fresh baits on them, whatever, cast them out. And then once they're cast out, I'll retouch up the three that I've already got, put new baits on them, put sticks on them, just kind of have them ready. So it's not really, but like those same six rigs will probably do the next session, maybe the session after as well. So it's not really organised. And to be honest, the hooks probably, I get to a point where I think that's not sharpening very good anymore. And then I get a new one out of the packet and it's so sharp compared to what I've probably been using for the last two sessions.
There's no point left.
Yeah, and I'm just sat there thinking I probably should have changed this a couple of sessions ago. But I'm too tired.
Even when you're in the vein like you've been this year, you know, you're on a roll, you've had, you know, a mega session, you've caught a couple of chunks, you know, you're not, does that not spur you on to, you know, get ready for the next one?
It was my last night. Fishing last night it was like a 3-4 night session, and I tied two new rigs for the first time in probably three sessions, which includes the last session at Nash's, which is on this in session now. I think I tied in three nights on Nash's, and I fished, you know, at least four rods on there, and I think I tied two new rigs during that session, and I think I probably tied two new rigs this session, and the rest have been touched up. So I'm a bit lazy and a bit tight. I don't like using the hook link material. If there's nothing wrong with it, I don't change it.
I'm the same. I do like to make sure everything is perfect going out. I've got that obsessive carp disorder. But do you think you'd be more prepared if you fished different sort of venues, if you weren't so keen on like the low stock sort of things? If you were, I don't know, on a linear or match carp angler where, you know, every second counts.
Certainly, yeah. Or when you're getting really small windows where there's a lot of fish. You know, like really finite bite times, but you know they're shellfish, so you get a really short window. Obviously, I adapt to any given situation. So, I remember Horseshoe back in the day when there was a lot of fish in there when I was young. You got a very short window. You could sit there spotting all day for the carp to move across you. You know, you'd get all your rods would go, and you might get a recast and a couple more bites. You might get five or six. And then the guy next year was catching down to the left. You could see the shoal moving around like the summer bay. And then in that kind of circumstance, I think, you know, I would make sure I had those rigs tied. So it was literally, you know, clipping you and on bang straight out while the fish is in the net. You're a bit like they do on matches. I know, remember reading Martin Clark's book when he was talking about Elstow 1 in his first book. And he wanted to catch 330s, was it, in the session? I think that was his kind of first. Shows how long ago it was now, because that's not uncommon these days. But it was a rare thing in those days. 30s were rare when he wrote that book, let alone catching three in a session. And the key to it was the same thing in there. There were shoal fish, and you were maybe fishing all three rods on one feature and with very deep water around it. And the key was the same there, was to have the rod back out like instantly, you know, have it ready to go. Maybe even have an extra rod set up behind you so that you can just flick it straight out again onto the spot. I mean, it's a lot easier now nowadays. Now we use distance sticks or wrap sticks, whatever you want to call them. You know, you could have spare rods. Like, you know, I've got a four rod set up. If you're fishing somewhere, you're only allowed to use two rods or three rods. You can have the third rod, your fourth rod wrapped up to the spot with a brand new rig on it, literally leaning up against a bivvy ready to go. You land a fish, you can bang that one straight out, clipped up. Yeah. I think we should be efficient, you know, maximising those chances. We speak about Roger Bacon a lot on here, but he's extremely good at maximising chances in any conditions. Those conditions where it's really windy and it's really hard to get on the spot, you know, he's efficient at doing it. And I've seen him catch, like, have five fish in a session where I would have caught three. You know, like fishing in that peg, doing the same thing, just because he maximised a really small window. So, yeah, it will definitely. I mean, I am a little bit lazy. A bit of me just enjoys being fishing, and when it starts to get really hard work, is that right? Why I'm there? I don't know. I'd rather just fish the low stock lakes where it's one bite a month, and you don't even have to worry about that stuff.
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I mean, so sort of related to that, what about how prepared are you when you're actually on the bank? You know, is your swim organised? You know, is everything to hand? You know, not just rigs, I'm talking about everything, your bivvy organisation.
Yeah, probably not speaking to the right person about this.
You have a bit of a mess, is it?
I always remember when I'd not long met John Mack, and I was on Yateley Car Park Lake. It was the first lake I ever met him on. And I remember seeing his setup, which was the opposite of mine. It was a bed chair with a brolly over it, and you couldn't see anything else. There was nothing strewn around the peg all over the place, and everything was super tidy, and everything had a place, and seconded set up, like the barrow was repacked, and, you know, which is great. I mean, he could have moved in a whisper, you know, if he needed to move or saw something somewhere. And the opposite end of that spectrum is probably Gary Bayes. if you've ever seen him fish, it's quite the opposite. He's a opposite side of the spectrum. It's just he doesn't put anything away. Everything goes out. Wherever he gets it out is where it stays for the entire session. So his peg is just doomed. So moving on to the injuries. I think we'll go to Ronnie first. He sums it up right at the start here. You can't call yourself a carp angler unless you've had a hook in the finger.
The thumbs count.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't had one for a long time. Since I was a kid, in fact, with much, much smaller hooks was the last time I put a hook in my finger, until this year, where I got one plumb square in the thumb. We did speak about it on the Carpcast, so we won't talk about that too much. But the hook in the finger, it's a pretty common one, isn't it? Hook past the Barbies. We've all had it, haven't we?
Well, most of us, and if you haven't, it's coming.
Yeah, be warned. If you sat there now thinking, I've not had one, be wary on your next session, because you know what happens when you think, I've never done that. It's literally straight it's straight away. I mean, my worst one was probably a little bit of karma. Not sure if we've spoke about this, probably not, but it was when I was guesting a lake that had two very large commons in it, a mid-50 and a upper-40. I was doing what everybody else did and fishing the nights, going over the gates and in there guesting. And I ended up catching a fish known as Jim's, which was a 48-pound at the time. I think that fish is like 54 now or something. But it was, 48 was big. The fish had got, since the first few lads discovered them and caught these fish many years earlier, they'd got quite big. And since they'd got big, it'd been kept reasonably on the low down. And so we didn't really know how big the fish were that we were fishing for, but you know, we knew they were decent 40s. As it turned out, they were very decent 40s and a 50. But I'd caught Jim's. I'd actually planned to be on the lake for the whole week. I'd made plans to be there for 5 days. Didn't have to go home or anything. I hadn't caught anything out of the lake at this point, and you could only fish like a small window of time, like sort of 10, half 10 at night till like 4:30 in the morning. And I ended up catching Jim's on a wet morning, drenched, ended up landing this fish of a lifetime. And one of the other chaps that was fishing, Mark, he was there at the time, he took the pictures. And I was like, should we go up to the service station nearby? I'll treat you to breakfast. Because I had no intention of leaving the lake. I was going to be there for the week, but just caught a fish and kind of wanted to celebrate. And it was, you know, a fish of a lifetime. So we've gone over, and I don't know if because there was somebody else there and I wasn't totally focusing. And I got to the top of this gate. It's one of the metal gates with spikes on it, you know, like the fences that the council put up and stuff that are like got three spiky prongs on the top of each strip of metal. And I'm cringing now thinking about it. I've actually put my hand underneath my legs, like, to protect them near my bollocks.
Your excuse?
Yeah, well, the fence is like taller than a person, so and, you know, taller than, like, if you, I'm 6 foot exactly, and I could probably just touch the top of the fence with the tip of my fingers, you know, like on tiptoes. And I've jumped over, caught my finger on it anyway, the inside of my finger, and it's like ripped all the way down my finger as I've dropped to the floor, like no way of avoiding it. And I don't even know if I can tell the story. It's making me cringe so bad.
Oh, you're going to have to carry on now. You can't lead a horse to water and not let him drink.
Oh, it was there was blood everywhere. I'm holding it shut. I know it's a really bad injury, but I daren't look. It's excruciating pain. There's blood spurting everywhere, and I just know it's really bad, but can't look. I wrapped my whole hand up and tried to keep the pressure on it because the blood was just everywhere, you know, like running onto the floor. And I couldn't drive. I felt sick. Mark ended up driving me. It's a good job he was there, really, but ended up driving me to Withenshaw Hospital, which happened to be the nearest hospital, which is a bit of a trek away. And I forget how many stitches I had now. It was like 14 stitches or something. And it was just, I don't know, like it was, the finger was open to the bone. Luckily none of the tendons were mashed up too badly. Like, I've got full movement in the finger now. Still numb at one side. Is it 2-3 years later now, something like that?
Still, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, still got no feeling in the tip of the finger on one side. It's just like dead, like numb. But all the doctors and nurses are coming in and they're like, oh, that's a good one. And they're calling each other in to have a look at it, you know. It's just like, oh. And I felt sick because I saw it. I had a pretty bad injury a few years before that was non-fishing related, but I came off a bike on a BMX track, of all things. And I ended up snapping my collarbone and puncturing a lung and breaking a rib, and I was in a bad way. I cracked my head as well. It's in a pretty bad way, but like I didn't see it happen. My friend who was behind me on the bike saw it all, and he had that same sick feeling that I had when I'd done my finger, because I saw what happened and I couldn't like get it out of my head, like just the finger ripping down the thing. And like it makes me like I have to protect myself when I'm even thinking about it now. And like the other injury that I had where I'd bust myself up on the bike, like I didn't see it, so like there's nothing to feel sick about, if you know what I mean. It just happened to me. And
so this thing with your hand, then, could you like see bones and tendons inside the wound?
You can see it all when they opened it up to clean it, like they injected it or numbed it all, and they actually prized it open, held it open, because they had to see if they needed to operate on the tendons and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, you can see the bone. It was just like, you know, bending around the top of this gate is probably, these spikes are probably 4 or 5 mil thick, so that was obviously the width of the opening all the way down the centre of the inside of my finger. I've got a pretty nice scar now, all the way up.
Yeah, we earn our scars, but the question that I'm thinking now, did you ever buy Marky's breakfast?
No, we never got there. He abandoned me at the hospital, so don't forget my vehicle's at the lake. Did he pick me up and take me back? I can't actually remember what happened. It was a bit of a... I must have attempted to drive my car home, which was like an hour home. So I don't know if he come and pick me up. I think he might have come and pick me up and took me to... I either got a taxi or he took me back to where my car is, and then I drove one-handed home with all my arm strapped up in a sling. But they completely dosed me on morphine and tramadol to take home. So I was in a bit of a haze, probably. I remember getting home, and it was a big, like the bandages and everything was massive. It was like a mummy, my arm and my hand. And I remember as the painkillers wore off, like the throbbing that set in, more from when they've like opened it up and cleaned it and messed around with it and everything. The throbbing was like nothing else. The worst bit of it was, like, I just caught a fish of a lifetime. We didn't know if there was bigger fish of a lifetime in there at the time. You know, there's probably at least one more, maybe two. And somebody had just seen my peg where I'd caught it from, and I couldn't go back in it for a week. So I was like, well, maybe longer. I didn't know how long I was going to be out of action for. So within a day, as soon as the throbbing started diving down, I'm like trying to strap, carrier bags to my arm, because the main thing they were saying is if you get it infected, like, you're in deep trouble, like, because it was like so deep, if it got any sort of infection, like, you can lose your finger and it's just really bad for you. So there was this like gamble of I need to get out on the bank, which is obviously not the most hygienic place, wet, muddy and all sorts of germs. I need to get on the bank like as soon as I can, but if I do it too early and it gets infective, it's going to knock me out for like longer. So like it was a bit of a balancing act of you know, what's the earliest I could possibly go. And I was wrapping bags around my hand and going in the garden every single day to see if I thought I could cast a rod and land a fish. And it was every day anyway. After about 5 or 6 days, I thought, I can do this. You know, it dulled right down, it's still all strapped up and everything. And I went and got the dressings changed, and then I did that. I went fishing. So it was probably like 7 days from when it actually happened. I went fishing with a carrier bag, like taped around my arm, but it was all sweaty, like, because obviously it's like sealed. It was pretty sweaty. So I ended up taking the chance taking the bag off in the night. Once everything was set up and sorted, took the bag off, and yeah, I ended up, took me about another 10 days to 2 weeks, I think, to actually finish the job, catch the other big common after that. But yeah, it was. I remember being like, it was double bubble, because like we just discovered like where I could catch a fish from after maybe 10-15 blank kind of 6 hour sessions, and all of a sudden I catch one of the big ones and then couldn't go back again. And this chap, Mark, and his pal Sam, they ended up catching 3 fish out of my peg while I was gone.
So, good angling.
Yeah, and obviously it felt like their peg by the time I got back, so I had to find a new peg. which obviously paid off in the end. But it was not good. I mean, that's one of the things. In fact, we released one of Frank Warwick's injury stories. He gave us two, and we actually released one as a teaser to these Carpcast extras. You can hear it on our website, same place that you can see all these. And that was the same story with him. He'd got an opportunity to fish on the Cons, which was like no chance of fishing there, just on 240s. Was it in mid-80s?
But, in like, winter as well.
Yeah, when they were really Martin big. Locke. That's right, yeah, of solar fame. He'd had 240s, and you know, Frank had got a baiting needle through his kidneys and was like, I don't care how much it hurts, I'm not leaving my one and only chance to fish this lake. that was kind of the feeling that I had when I'd done my finger. I just had to get back there. But let's get away from my story. And let's go to... we've got two from our Belgian friend, Ronnie de Grota. Should we do one and then the other one a bit later?
Yeah, it's going both in. I think double bubble from Ronnie has got to be good.
Well, you know, and then fishing injuries, I think if you fish long enough, something happens to you at the bank. Look, we are not cyclists, so it doesn't mean that we fall from a bicycle every other week, you know, like what happens in the classics and so on. But at least a hook in the finger. This is something what you have. If you never had a hook in your finger, you're not an angler. No. I think, no, this is, you know, but and that is something what happens to me in Saint-Coq in France also many years ago. So I was fishing there. It was a very sunny Sunday afternoon. For one or another reason, my wife was with me. So normally she never goes fishing with me because, you know, I try to please her when I'm on the bank, and that means that I'm not fishing very well. And on the other hand, she does not really enjoy it that much. So she does not have a good time. I don't really have a good time. So it's better that we spend some quality time somewhere else together and that I do my thing and she does her thing. But
of course.
For one or another reason, she was with me at Lake de Dare. It's too long ago to remember why she was with me anyway. So we were fishing on the right hand side of the church of Lake Saint-Coq, or Lake de Dare, you know, in the Saint-Coq, and there is a bay, and I was fishing at long range. So during the night the carp moved in, but during the day the carp moved out at long range. So I got a take at one particular moment, so I took the boat, I boated out, and I played the carp from the boat, you know, whatever, 200, 300 meters from the bank. It was not really big one. I said, okay, I don't take it with me to the bank, just gonna take the hook out, let it go back, drop the my rig again in the swim and boat again to the bank. But so I called that carp. It was not a really big one, I guess something like upper double, maybe low 20 maximum. So I took the hook, I pulled it out of the mouth of the carp, but the carp was still in the water. So it shaked its head, and that hook went into my finger. I can swear you, you know, it went far behind the bound, the bend of the hook. Yeah, you know, I was swearing like a drunken sailor. I, you know, if I was still a virgin, a holy virgin in those days, well, I was ready for hell after that. Who can I? You know, it was. So anyway, so I was really upset, not because it hurts, because at that particular moment, you know, your body makes adrenaline, yeah. So you don't feel it. But I was so angry about myself, and I called myself all, you know, kind of stupid words and whatever. So I went back to the bank. So in the meantime, of course, I had cut my line, but the rig was still dangling under my hand. So I arrived in the swim. So I took a plier and I wanted to, you know, to push the hook through the skin.
Yeah.
Cut the barb I returned it the way it came in. It didn't want to move for, I would not say an inch, for a millimeter. So I said, well, you know, damn it, what the fuck has happened here to me? I say, at that moment, two German guys, you know, two units, you know how Germans are. Yeah. 1 meter 85, 1 meter 90s, you know, wrestlers kind of type, and they came in the swim. And they say, you know, we will pull that hook out. I said, look, if you both want to go down now, within 7 seconds, you just have to tell me, you know, and this something from somebody who is 1 meter 68. Yeah. I could fit in the pocket from their from the jacket they were wearing, you know. Yeah. But anyway, so they, you know, they did a step backwards. No, that's not that much. They did. It's not over a little bit over accelerated, of course. But anyway, it was funny. Tell me.
Did you get it out? Did you manage to get it out?
No, of course not. But, the story is not finished. On that particular moment, I got another take. So, stupid me, I still hadn't cut the hook link. So, that hook link still was hanging under my hand, you know. I ran to my rod, grabbed my other rod, and that hook link got twisted in my line. Oh. So, that hook went into it a little bit deeper. Oh. So, now it was complete, you know. Now it was proper hooks, you know. So anyway, that carp, I lost, you know. I lost it. So I reeled in, and it was, you know, I could not get that hook out my thumb. So there was no other possibility than driving to the nearest hospital. So I cut the hook link. That hook was still in my thumb, so it went under my nail. And if I pushed under the other side, other side of my thumb, I could feel it. So it's really proper in there. So I arrived in the hospital. That was in San Diego. So I arrived at, how do you say that, the reception. I said, excuse me, sir, I have a little problem, and I stubbed my thumb. They say, don't worry, we will take care of that. I say, okay, you know, but then in France, so yeah. I tried to imitate some France guys talking in English at the moment. So we went to the theater. It was summer, sunny Sunday, and nobody wanted to die in that village, so the doctors had a lot of time at their disposal. So within a couple of minutes, there were two doctors and four nurses in that theater. Wow. So I said to one of the doctors, I said, look, mate, I think I think it's best that, you know, try to push it through the other side of my thumb, cut the barb, and then we can probably return it. He said, don't worry, I'm a carp angler, myself. One of the nurses said, I didn't know that you were an angler. I said, look, mate, we are not going to make jokes with each other. I said, if you hurt me, I will hurt you. So within a second, you know, are we agree? So within seconds, you know, we had a laugh. Everybody was laughing. My wife was not allowed to enter the theater, so she was waiting in the corridor, and she said, what's going on? After I left the theater, she said, what's going on? I said, yeah, I just got to talk with that doctor. And we had a good laugh. So, you know, this is... But at the end of the day, so he got it out. I had an injection in my thumb with one of other whatever tranquilizer or whatever you call it in English. Yeah. He put it out, and you know, it everything went okay.
Did you get back to the lake?
Of course.
Of course.
Of course. Well, just because of a hook in your finger.
Yeah.
No, of course I went, and I'm sure I caught a couple of more carp from that swim. So it was good.
So before we go back to Ronnie, his second injury, let's check back in on this session.
This is what we came for.
got a chunk in the net, very pretty mirror. Initial impression, say it's £40, maybe mid 40. It's a lump. Pretty heavy fight. The take on my rod that's put up on the islands around the corner. Had a really, really big ball of silkweed around it that was stopping me having direct contact to the fish. It was a heavy weight underneath, so a bit of a hair-raising fight. Eventually coaxed it over the net cord, lifted the net, and it does feel heavy. It's definitely £40, I think. I'll get the fish sorted, get the rod back out, and I'll be back. So the dust has settled, got the rods back out, done the pictures, did a live video, £48.7, fish that was on the final account DVD that Kevin braced off the top. He braced 250s, that was one of them. Fantastic fish, golden coloured, red belly, stunning carp, as most of them are. In both this lake, the Copse Lake and the Church Lake next door, I mean, somebody's always impressed me. I've had maybe 5 or 6 40s out of the Church Lake over the years, and they've all been absolutely amazing. Looking like they have a sheen on them, you know, just really good condition. You can tell how good the water quality and the biomass and everything is in these lakes. And you know, I've had a fish that's almost £50, has been £50 in the past, and what a chunk it was. So just got over the capture. I didn't fish last night because I was up at Kev's house interviewing him. I did flick the rods out about 1 o'clock in the morning when I got back. Nothing happened overnight. I think I've been done on the same rod that I caught the 48. I think I've been done on that rod this morning. I had a short series of beeps, and then it dropped back, and I checked the rod, picked it up, there's nothing there, and the lead had come off and the tubing had been blown back. So I'm pretty sure it must have been pretty fast takes, put the lead off, and with the barbless hooks and stuff that you use on here, the fish has just shook its head and managed to flick the hook out. So I put a rod back on that spot. I've changed two rods to zigs. The pressure's risen about 20 points, something like that. It's been a pretty severe pressure rise. It's overcast today. I mean, it does feel quite carpy. There's no wind. But the bobbins are very quiet. I've got rods scattered all around, covering a decent portion of the lake. Got two zigs out, and it's just very, very quiet. But I'm confident of... obviously it was the last night tonight, I'm going home in the morning, I'm confident of a bite before I go home, but I don't really know how that's going to pan out. The spot that I had's big enough and may have been done on this morning. I'm confident of that rod maybe going tomorrow morning, but I think that it's going to be quite clear tonight, so it's going to feel a good degree colder. But I'm still feeling confident, but I would like another one before I go home. So I redid my final couple of rods just before dark and see what the night brings.
Have you got any injuries, Mark, that we haven't already mentioned?
Well, at the risk of repeating myself, no. But I do want to tell you about a close escape.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is my one and only trip down to Kevin Nash's Church Lake. And I was getting prepared. I was tying some rigs. And you know that soft bit of flesh in between your thumb and pointy finger?
Yeah.
Yeah, a size 4 curved shank hook. I think, obviously, it would have been a fang. Yeah, the lead attached to the rig rolled off my leg and pulled the hook in there right up to the bend. And, my God, that hurt.
Yeah.
But, as you know, Kevin Nash has a barbless hook rule. I think that's probably the first time I've actually obeyed a barbless hook rule, so it came straight back out. I'm so glad I did.
There must be no better feeling than putting a hook bang smack in your finger and realising there's no barb on it.
Oh yeah, it was a sense of relief. Having ended up in hospital with a hook in my thumb before, you've kind of like pulled it out, there's a little pinprick of blood and then that's all. There's no swelling, no throbbing, no... I was twisting it and I just carried on tying the rig and still caught nothing.
Cool. Well, let's go back to Ronnie, shall we? Get his next one.
So that was one thing, and another injury was when I was in Suriname, in South America.
Yeah.
So you know that I'm fish for more than just carp alone.
Yes.
And we were fishing at the Corantena River near the Wanatobo Falls. One of the very first expeditions that went to that area. And so, in fact, we were exploring that area. The Wanatobo Falls are about, if you don't know, you know, Suriname. Corantena River is the biggest river in Suriname. It's a natural border between Guyana and, I think it's British Guyana. Yeah, British Guyana, I think, and Suriname. A natural border for many kilometers, and the Wanatobo Falls are about, let's say, 280, 300 kilometers upstream from Nikiri. Nikiri is the second city in Suriname. So there are, let's say, two big cities, which is Paramaribo, the capital, Nikiri. And I think in those two big cities together, they have about 50% of the inhabitants of Suriname. And then you have a country which is as big as, I don't know, maybe it's as big as England, I don't know, but something like that. And they live about, I don't know, 5% of people in the rest of the Suriname compared with the two big cities. So anyway. So we went to the Wanatobo Falls, two days in the boat, and we were fishing below the Wanatobo Falls, catching peacock bass, which is one of my favorite fishes. Of course, when you fish in South America, you catch piranhas, that is a pest over there. We were catching red-tailed catfish, and we tried to catch paraiba or the lalau, which is the biggest catfish of South America. Mm. But as it was an expedition, we also wanted to fish above the waterfalls. But to go above the waterfalls, we first has to cross the jungle for, let's say, 3/4 of an hour to up to 1 hour before we could go from below the waterfalls to above the waterfalls. And then we had to boat out. We had to go to, through white water with the boat before we came in a bit of calm water. So we were fishing there. We were catching, you know, tiger catfish. We caught red tails. We caught peacock bass. We caught piranhas. And at a certain moment, I catch a tiger catfish, not really a big one. And as I was not familiar with that catfish, I just wanted to have a picture with it. And I put it behind, how do you call that, the fins, which are on the side of the body of a fish.
Oh, yeah, pecs.
Pectoral
fins.
Yeah, pectoral fins. So I grab it there, and with my left hand, I hold it by the tail. And at that moment, it shook with it had, and it cut my hand open just below my thumb. And that was, I can tell you, it's just one big hole in there. And there is nothing. You easily can put a needle from one side from your hand to the other side, and of course you will feel that it goes through it, but there is no muscle at all. But I was very lucky that no veins get caught or cut, or no nerves also. So I was very lucky. I think 2 or 3 millimeters further, and I had been in big trouble. But that was the second day of our expedition, and we still had another 12 days to go. And you were about 300 kilometers away from the nearest doctor. Wow. In the worst conditions for infections that you can imagine. So, 30 degrees, humidity of 90% or something like that, 100%. Yeah. So, you know, and the one who organized the trip, Anton, a Dutch guy, he said, we have to go back, you know, to the base camp. I say, we cannot go to base camp. It was then, it was already night then. So when I cut my hand, you know, it was like, you know, shit, does it have to happen to me? So I looked to the Indian guy, there was an Indian. And the funny thing was, I could talk in Dutch with him, because Suriname is a former Dutch colony. Yes, so I asked him, I said, is it poisoned? He said, no. And he showed me his leg, and he said, look, I had a pectoral fin into my leg, and that was, you know, a mark as big as a fist, for example. And I said, is there poison? He said, no, don't worry, it's no poison. I said, okay, that was already a good thing. Because I also did not want to, how did I have to say this, to destroy the expedition, or, you know, that I had to go back to the civil war, the thing was that we were not that far away from a little village from Indians, but their medicine man, who was to a meeting which was about 1,000 kilometers away, so there was certainly nothing around that could help me. I said, look, and the other thing is, you cannot, how do you do, is that shoeing with needle and
stitching, yeah.
Stitching, okay, you cannot stitch a wound after when it has been open for, let's say, 6 hours.
Right.
So you have to do it the first couple of hours. We did not have, we had a few little things with us, but the main tools were in the base camp. So and it was in the night, and Tom said, yeah, we have to go back to the base camp. I said, no, you cannot go back to the base camp, for the very simple reason that, first of all, we have to go to through white water with a boat, which is already dangerous during the daylight. And I said, it certainly is dangerous during the night, because it's more difficult to see the rocks and so on. And I said, secondly, we have to walk 1 hour through the jungle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that at the moment when the jungle mosses, the coral snakes and whatever are active, I said, now we have to stay here. And in the early morning, we go back to the base camp and we see what we can do. So so we stayed there that night, early morning. We went back to the base camp. We cleaned it, and you know, I fished the other 12 days. I think we were still there, just with a bandage around my hand. But we continued fishing, and luckily, I did not have to go back 300 kilometers downstream to Nikiri, to the doctor. So that wound took about, if I'm not wrong, 6 or 7 weeks to close and heal completely.
Wow. But you're still here to tell the tale.
Yeah, and I'm still here. So, but that was, it's like, also, it didn't hurt, and it hasn't hurt afterwards, because there are not really nerves there. And as I said, the moment you have an injury, the first moment, your body makes so many adrenaline. So you don't really feel it. It's only after a while that you start to feel it. But as there were no nerves in that area, and luckily enough that I did not cut muscles and so
tendons
on.
Tendons and nerves.
Yeah.
Something about Ronnie, I could just listen to him all the time. I know you've just had almost a 16-minute double bubble of him. But, he's pretty interesting. And being injured in the middle of the jungle, I mean, that's slightly different to pulling a hook in your finger. there's some places where you probably don't want to get ill. And a long way from civilization is probably one of them, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you think, when you watched all the Jeremy Wade River Monsters, some of the play, I mean, I don't know, he's got his film and crew and that, but have you seen that one where they get struck by lightning?
No, I've not seen that one.
Oh, mate, you'll have to go on YouTube and find it, mate. You know, one of the crew gets, you know, seriously injured, and I can't remember where they are, but they're pretty much the back end of nowhere. And it really is
well, one, they're quite worried. He's, you know, like got his head wrapped up and he's in and out of consciousness. And
wow,
yeah, not something I want to experience.
We take it for granted in the UK, don't we? That you know, that when I put the hook in my thumb not long back, I was 5 minutes from a hospital. You know, I was 15-minute drive from Woodenshaw Hospital when I did my finger. We take it for granted, don't we? That we moan about the NHS and stuff, but we, you know, it's always there if you do something. You're not normally too far from help, unless you're stuck on top of a mountain or something like that. And again, we have the air ambulance and stuff. So, but being in a foreign country, not really knowing anything, or the jungle, or you know, wow.
The best you can hope for is a witch doctor.
Let's move on to Alan Blair's story. I'm sure a few of these are going to be hook stories, but this is a hook story and a little hook story twist at the end, I think.
A twister.
Fishing in... That's your fault.
It's a tongue tire.
Fishing injuries. Touch wood.
You found some.
I've just found a nice railway sleeper. I haven't actually had that many, Jamie. However, I can recall a story from last year. I was fishing, big group of us, and it was late at night. I'd had a 37, I'd had a 59, and I'd had a nice catfish, and I was just sort of in a moment of buzz, like ecstatic, lent my rod up against the umbrella, and I had a 4-ounce lead on, and it sort of slid down the side of the umbrella and in that motion pulled a hook into my finger. Now, I know you did it last week, we've all done it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was right in. I manned up because of the buzz and I proceeded to pull it out of my hand. Not a problem, job done, buzzing, got a big fish, numerous big fish in the sack, and I got on with the night. It was only a couple of hours later I went up to see Kev, who was just a short way up the bank from me, and sitting with him having a drink. One of his rods goes off, and I'd already told him about my hook in the finger thing, and we both laughed it off. Anyway, so he's playing his fishing, and we get it in, up on the cradle, and between the pair of us, it was dark. I didn't have a head torch. He didn't know where his was. We went to go and unhook said fish, and in the process of unhooking it, the hook went into the net mesh, into my finger, and then it started flapping.
Oh,
so really bad, Jamie, really bad. Flap, flap, flap. Kev's on top of the carp. I'm screaming like a little girl. In the end, we had to cut the hook link, making sure the fish was all right. Fish went into a retainer sling, but by this point, it had gone right into my hand, like big time. Now, bearing in mind, only a couple of hours earlier, I'd pulled one out myself, not a problem. This one was a whole lot worse. Now, other than this night, I've only ever once in my whole life put a hook in my hand. So in the space of 2 hours, I've now got two fang hooks into my hand. Anyway, this one wasn't coming out. And I walked off into the woods on my own, and Kev still to this day says he can hear the sounds I was making. But I've wandered off into the depths of the woods, and I proceeded to start taking the hook out. And I learned a while ago that the best way to do it is to exert pressure either side of the point as hard as possible, and then try and force it back out. And I remember popping the hook back out through various parts of my hand, and I could hear it going pop, 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 until I got it to a point I couldn't get it out any further. And then I'd just paced up and down, up and down, up and down, not really knowing what to do myself. And this went on for probably about, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour. And eventually, bang, I popped it out of my hand. And that was all within the space of 2 hours. Two hooks in my hand. The second one, bearing in mind there was a fish flapping around on the mat, it really was quite painful. But just to finish off, this one wasn't on the bank. It's another hook-related story. Not long after I started working for Kev, we were sitting in the office together and we were tying rigs. We were both due to go fishing. And we were tying up combi rigs. And I'll never forget this to the day I die. I don't know if I've ever told you this story before. Kev was sitting on one side of the desk. I was sitting on the other side of the desk. It was just us two in the office. He, like me, uses his teeth for lots of fishing-related, you know, biting hook lengths, blah, blah, blah. He's put the hook near his mouth, and he's pulled down on the combi knot, and I swear on my life, he pulled a size 6 Fang X into the bottom of his lip, dead centre.
Oh.
And he looked at me, and he said, "Get it out." Now, I hardly knew the bloke. I've been working for him for a few weeks, and he's like, "Get the hook out of my mouth." So I'm fumbling around with his lip, trying to get a handle on this. Anyway, like, it weren't going to work. So I had to go and get Sarah, where I'm managing director, and she come in, and between me and Sarah, we yanked this Fang-X out of the bottom of Kevin Nash's lip. So yeah, injuries, that is probably as bad as it gets for me. Touch wood, hopefully nothing worse will happen in years to come.
Yeah, I mean, being new at Nash and having to rip a hook out of Kevin Nash's lip, the big boss man, is that something you'd want to do? Undo it to myself, or unlight it. I don't know if I could do it to anyone. I'm a little bit squeamish at these sorts of things.
No, I'm not squeamish in that way. If I'm not going to feel any pain, then no, I'll just give me the forceps and I'll yank away and rip it. But
could you be a doctor? No. Like a surgeon operating in a theatre, could you actually take a knife, cut somebody's skin open, even if you know they're under the knife and couldn't? I think I'm too squeamish.
Yeah, I probably could. You know, I mean, years back, even when I was a kid, I was having a little minor operation. My ingrowing big toenail was being removed.
Yeah, I had one of them.
Yeah, they're not much fun, are they? They're very painful. But, you know, I'm laid down, numb my toe up with a needle, and I kept trying to sit up because I want to watch him remove my nail. And said, no, sit down, Mark. I said, sir, I want to watch. And it was quite, I remember it to this day. It's one of these things that's imprinted on my brain. How they got these, like, scissor forceps thing, they prized the nail up and cut down the middle.
Yeah.
And then just kind of yanked at one side and then the other. And then even that split second from the nail leaving and this great big wad of gauze being plundered onto it, the amount of blood that oozed out of my nail bed.
Yeah, I had exactly the same thing. Yeah, I had it a couple of times. Horrible. I am screaming. I don't get scared easy about stuff, but I can't. If something comes on the TV, I can't watch Casualty or anything like that. I just, I don't know if my relation, I don't know the connection. Like, that's what I'm saying. I'm not sure I could be a surgeon, like, cutting somebody else's skin open, because I'd just be thinking what it feels like to me if somebody was cutting my skin open on my arm. I couldn't do it. And because skin's quite tough, isn't it? I have watched people cut into stuff, and, like, you know, your skin is pretty resilient. Resilient is there to protect your internal stuff, isn't it?
It is pretty tough, but you mentioned squeamish. I was not fishing related, but I've got to tell you this squeamish story because it's brilliant.
I'm already feeling a bit uncomfortable.
I've got a scar on my left arm. I call it my pet slug. Mm. It's from when I was attacked by a dog that was a lassie dog, a rough collie. Anyway, I had a bit of a mean streak, and it decided it wanted to eat me. But it's on my left arm, just above the inside of the elbow. Is actually where its claw went in, and it ripped about an inch and a half. And, I've got, like, all these, like, little puncture wounds where my wrist, where it's had it. I've got, it took a chunk out of my right calf as well. And I can't remember how old I was at the time. I think I was only about 12 or 13. There's only me and my brother in the house. Once we got, because it was our bloody dog as well. Mm. Once we got away from the dog and shut it in the kitchen, my brother got the neighbour, who was an absolute man mountain, called Heath, and he saw what's happened, and he's driven me to the to Casualty, like the nice fella he was. But we all, the adrenaline's going. I don't know what's gone up with my upper arm where its claws gone. I'm looking at my calf, got shorts on, and my wrist. We're halfway to hospital, and my arm feels wet, so I roll my sleeve up, and it's kind of gone like an inch and a half square of open arm flesh. And Heath, this absolute, well, just gentle giant he was, absolutely lovely fella, he's driving along. I'm not going to repeat what he says because there might be children to listen to this. But he was like, cover it back up, effing hell. And I'm just looking at it, and I start, like, poking it. He's like, everything, pack it in, cover it up. He was having a proper wobbler.
My daughter can watch. She could be, she wanted to be a vet for a while. I think she's going to do some sort of zoo type stuff. But she could. She's happily watching gory stuff. She's young. I'm the opposite. I can't. I'm really squeamish about stuff like that. Ugh, no good. Which is probably not a good topic for me. to be getting stuck into, but. Shall we move on and take another one then? Another one of our favourite storytellers and all-round nice guy, Mr. John Mack. And here's something we may all be able to relate to sometime or another.
Well, my worst fishing injury. I've had a few. And when I was down the railway, I mean, I've had the finger straight through the hook and all the rest of it, pulled it out with pliers and all the rest of it. But I think the worst fishing injury, I was on a week session down the railway in Kent, and I was my first night in. I always used to take the same food. I mean, we do, don't we? And I used to take chicken burgers in breadcrumb and a tin of baked beans. I used to have that as a dinner, like, you know, a couple of chicken burgers and some beans in there. And so I fry the burgers, take them off the stove, stick the beans in the saucepan, and then boil the beans in the way you go. But this particular time, I put a little bit too much oil in the frying pan, and it was fairly, like, you know, you normally just put a little drizzle in there like you would with bacon, but I put a fair bit in there, and they were boiling, you know, sizzling away, should I say. And literally, I took the frying pan off after they were cooked. And the fat was absolutely red hot. I got the spatula, flicked out the burgers in the saucepan where the beans were. And I don't know why, you know when you sort of flick the fat out of the frying pan? Well, I had hold of the handle and I sort of lifted it up to flick it. And obviously I lifted it up and all the fat in the frying pan tipped over the back of my hand. And it's like, it was that hot, you know, when you tip it on the ground and it just makes everything, like the grass, like bubble and sizzle where it's so hot. You know, it was straight onto the back of my hand and it was agony, I can tell you. I was like, looking at it, it didn't really look that bad. But I thought, oh, what are you supposed to do with burns and fat and this and that? You hear all the stories. So I put it in the lake. It was freezing. It was like October or November. It was a cold session at the start of a week. Put my hand in the water, and in the end I thought, I know what, I'll go and ask my mate Ted, Ted Bryan, and he used to be full time on there, great guy, and one of my best mates, still is, and I went round, I went, Ted, my hand, mate, my hand, I said, I know it don't look bad, but look, it looks a bit red, doesn't it, well, it looks like someone's just slapped the back hand, you know, back of your hand. He went, oh, give it here, and he tried grabbing it, and just say, you know, you wimp sort of thing, and he would just stick it in the water, so I put it in the water, and still, like, an hour's going by, and it's absolutely red hot. He said, oh, well, why don't you just go up to the chemist? There was, like, a late-night chemist, you know, up to about midnight up in one of the villages nearby. Drove up there. I remember driving. I was driving along, like, my feet on the pedals. I was so hot when I had my hand in the van that I had to stick to my left hand. I had to put my left hand outside the driver's window. So I'm driving with my right hand, pedals are changing with my feet, and I'm changing the gears with my right hand whilst trying to keep my left hand out the window. Every time I sort of bring it in, it just, the warmth of the van would just, like, kill you. I went into the chemist, showed them, they went, no, we haven't got anything for that. Have you done that? So I told them, and they said, you've got to go up to the hospital. And I'm like, are you joking? Are you serious? No, that is really bad what you've done. So I went up to the hospital. I'm in there for a couple of hours. I hand in ice bucket. In the end, my hand swelled up the size of, a massive balloon. And they syringed all the fluid out. They bandaged it and put cream on it. And I had to go back every day for 10 days. And I'm on the start of a week session. And every day I had to wind in and go up the hospital for a couple of 2 or 3 hours. I mean, obviously the session was ruined, but it was, the agony. And Frying Pan John was my nickname after that. Frying Pan John, yeah. I had a few nicknames down there. I won't tell you all of them.
Yeah, we all need to be careful with the boiling fat. You know, when you're pouring it out of those Ridge Monkeys or whatever you're using, be super careful. You don't want boiling fat all over you. We've all had splatters and stuff, haven't we? But taking half your hand off is probably not advised. Let's check back in on the session.
It's 5 p.m. on my final evening. Yeah, I've got to go about 11 a.m. tomorrow. I've just had another bite. The rod that I had the 48.5 off, it was the same rod, which is the one that I think I got done on this morning as well. Just had a take, same sort of bite, dropped back off the island. It's like quite a deep margin and it bumps down really hard, really solid, gravelly. It's like it's the nicest spot on the lake that I've found. To be fair, I wished I'd fished it the last time I was here, but I didn't try anything in that area. But yeah, it's just gone again. It's another uncaught common that's obviously bred in here. Not a long one this time like the first one. It was had quite a gut and it was much shorter and with a really decent gut. Quite heavy thing for its size. I didn't weigh it, but I'm guessing it's about 18 pounds. So yeah, it's a good sign. I mean, conditions have totally changed. Sun's been out all afternoon. The sun's had some heat in it as well, so I've been moving my zigs around all day into different areas where I think the sun, where I think a carp might be, because it's been pretty flat calm all day. So, you know, just all the comfortable areas where the sun's been beaming. But I've not had a touch on the zigs. Moved, you know, shortened a couple and just messed around, but nothing. And then obviously that one on me, what I'm now calling my banker spot. So I think there'll be a chance on that rod in the morning, maybe overnight as well. There definitely seems to be fish in that area. But would like one of the other rods to go. But we'll see. We've got a night and a morning bite time to go. I mean, kind of probably last night here. So fingers crossed.
What a cold night that was. It's just amazing how on a smallish lake, it's happened a couple of times this year so far. One really cold night, it was down to like -4, just killed the action. Thought I might have had another bite before I went home, but I woke up to everything frozen. Lake wasn't frozen, but you know, all the water inside the unhooking mat was like an inch thick. It was a hell of a cold night, and it's killed it. As I've just left, it was the opposite. It was t-shirt weather, probably 13, 14 degrees, and really comfortable. I expect to see the fish moving about today, but that's it. Three nights, three fish landed. Potential, I think I had another two bites in total I didn't connect with. You know, drop back tight bites and fishing barbless hooks. The fish got off both times. But extremely happy with the session, extremely happy to catch one of the A-team again. And hopefully I'll get a chance to go back there maybe next winter. But yeah, it's got to go down. It's a fantastic session. Got some really good material recorded with Kevin. Had a nice meal with him. And yeah, it's just a dream session.
So we've got one final injury story, and that's Mr. Storyteller Frank Warwick. We had a story from him on the Carpcast Extra Teaser, which, as we said earlier, you can get. And he gave us another one. And I forget what it's about. Do you remember, Mark?
I don't know. I think you're just going to have to let it roll and we'll see.
Okay, Mr. Frank Warwick.
Right, this is a second story of injuries that's happened to me on the bank. This one's a fairly nasty one. I was writing my book, so I didn't go fishing for 3 months. I just sat and wrote every day, 6-7 hours a day, which is unusual for me, but I had to force myself to do it, or else I would have never finished the book. So I was gagging to go out fishing, and I'd got back in that Acton Burnell. I'd been in it years ago, and it really, you know, it wasn't my kind of venue in some respects, but I know a guy that's quite a wealthy fella, and he I'd done him a few favours, and he surprised me and dropped it on my toes and said, by the way, I've got you an Acton Burnell ticket, which as a surprise. And I thought, hang on a minute, about £1,000 or something or more. Anyway, I didn't argue. I thought, well, you know, what a nice gesture. So it was quite amazing. But I hadn't been there for years. And I thought, well, I'm going to go on and retrace my steps, because I had quite a lot of success on there for the little time I fished it. I had a lot of fish out of it, and, you know, quite a few 40s out of it and that. And the fish had got considerably bigger in the interim. So I went back on. I was greeted by the bailiff, Nick Jones, telling me that, he said, oh, Frank, he said, Rob Ailes has just rung up and told me that the method's still banned, and the plastic con and all the things that you like using. But they'd relaxed the ban, but when I got back in, they put the ban back on. That's what I'd been so successful on in the past. And Rob Brettender was pressuring the fish. I thought, well, what are you here for if you're not pressuring the fish? You know, that you're there to catch him. Anyway, so everything that I took, all the method and everything, was banned. I thought, oh, great, this is not good. So I went down, and there was a scouser on there called Paul that I know, and he'd struggled on it, and he'd gone 9 months between bites, which was, I was amazed at that. Anyway, I got in this sandy point, and I thought, right, I'll just fish single baits to suss out what I'm going to be doing. So I put one rod in, turned me back, and the spool was spinning. So I had a 25-10. So I thought, oh, that's all right. It's still being kind to me, this place. Anyway, I just started fishing, and then the phone goes off, and it's Tim Paisley. He says, right, Warwick, he says, you're going to have to pack in whatever you're doing and come over to Angling Pubs. There's some final bits with the book before it goes to print that you've got to sort out. So I was in a right mood. You know, you can imagine, you just had one after about 12, 14 years of being away from the place. Got the swims looking good, and I've got to pack up. And it was a right nightmare getting through to the swim, because it'd been raining heavy, and, you know, I'd gone through all this mud to get there, and I'd got to pack up in pouring rain and mud. So I was in a right mood. And I comes to my van, and I packed everything back in the van, and I had one of them Nash wheelbarrows. So I tried to get the handles out of the wheelbarrow, and I couldn't get the bloody things out. They were wedged in solid. So I slackened the nuts off, and I couldn't get the handles out to get it in the van. So I was losing my rag with it, and I was smashing it with my hands, and I ended up sticking it down, upending it where the wheel is on the floor, standing on it and getting the palms of my hand with the handles facing me and the crossbar facing my face. And I really got pissed off at it, so I'm slamming it with both hands trying to get the bars out. And you know, when you really lose your rag and you get that sort of superhuman strength, and I slammed it, and in one swift move the handle bars came out and the crossbar fired up into my face, hit me top lip and hit me nose. Anyway, my nose exploded, broke it in four places and fractured my skull. It drove my nose into my head. It was like one of them martial arts killer blows that sort of nearly takes your head off. And my nose exploded, and I had a hemorrhage, and I must have lost 2 pints of blood. I took my shirt off trying to stop it, and it just wouldn't stop, both nostrils firing out like a bucket. And I started laughing at myself, shaking my head, thinking that was the biggest blow I've ever had in my life in the face. I mean, I've had tons of scraps and that, but that was an absolute wowser. So I was laughing at the idiocy of myself being such a cock doing that, you know. And basically, I took my shirt off, mopped all the blood up. I looked in the wing mirror on the van, and I didn't recognise my own face. All you could see was my nostrils, where the top of my nose was. It had driven my nose right into my head and crumpled it. So the worst thing was, I had to pack up and go to Angling Pubs, And that very weekend, I was supposed to drive down to Emperor Lakes in Devon and do a TV programme with John Bailey, with my son, Jamie. He was going to be in this Mr. Crabtree film, and I was supposed to be in it, and I looked like the bloody elephant man. And I thought, oh, shit. And every time I tried speaking, I sounded like Frank Sidebottom. So, anyway, I got home and looked in the mirror, and I thought, oh, my God. It was just surreal. So I thought, right, I'm going to have to pull my nose out and try and straighten it. So I got it, and I could hear the bones cracking in it. And I pulled my nose and pulled it out and tried to straighten it, and it didn't look right. It was like a Z. My nose. I've got photos of it. You want to see the photos. And it bled again. I had another hemorrhage. But I didn't go to hospital. I'm a right stubborn old bugger me. I hate hospitals and messing around. So I thought, oh, it'll just be okay. So I went down to Devon with my lad, and I couldn't appear in the film properly because I looked so bad and I couldn't speak properly. And then I started getting all this crap coming out of my nose like black blood. And I put my fingers in my nostrils and I could feel pieces of bone sticking out of cartilage. And like a big sack of blood in my nose, and I couldn't breathe proper. So after 8 days, I knew something bad was going on. So I went to Withinshaw Hospital. Sat for 4 hours in casualty like you do, waiting for your turn. Went through, and then this doctor came into the cubicle and he says, what have you been doing? And I told him, and he went, we can't deal with this. He said, it's mega serious. He said, I can see your septum in your nose is exposed with cartilage sticking out. He says, what have you done? I told him about me trying to straighten it. He says, you have to go to the ear, nose and throat department right now. So I went in there. They got the top surgeon out to have a look, and he goes, you've cut off the blood supply to your septum, and he says, your nose is starting to rot, you're going to lose your nose. We're going to have to do facial reconstruction. And he says, you're coming in now, you've been admitted now, and you need an emergency operation. We think you're going to lose your nose. He's dead. So I went in, and they put me in a facial reconstruction ward. And there's all people who've got cancer that's had the face off, and oh, there was some hideous sights in there. So I started getting a bit worried by this stage. Anyway, I had a 3-hour operation, and they showed me the extent of the damage, and he said, you've got a 30% chance of success and a 70% chance of losing your nose and have to have your face rebuilt. So this is just from putting a wheelbarrow away, Jamie.
It's pretty gruesome. I'm sat here cringing and moved
on. Yeah, so yeah, so that wasn't great. So you know, don't be careful what you're doing when you lose your temper. Is all I'll say about.
And make sure you go to the hospital as well.
yeah. So that was a very unsavoury. Hey, I'll tell you what, when I came round from the operation, I had a plastic stick sticking out of my nose. It felt like someone had got a blowtorch and had it up my nostrils, and then I had two things that I can only describe that looked like women's tampons hanging out of my nostrils with blood dripping out of it. And when it came to taking these things out after a couple of days, they pulled them out by the strings. And it felt like they were sucking my brain out.
Oh
my God. It's just,
I can't take anymore.
Yeah, most excruciating pain you can ever imagine, mate. Unbelievable.
You don't want to be knocking yourself out with your wheelbarrow, breaking your nose or whatever. Can't be fun. Have you ever broke your nose? Or been punched on it?
I never have. I've got a long enough reach to keep people at bay, thankfully.
Yeah, it's an odd organ, your nose, isn't it? It's like, it's this thing that sticks out right on the front, and it's the first place people aim for when they want to bop you on it. And it's quite soft, really, isn't it? You know, you see boxers, and I see all sorts of people with crooked noses where they've, you know, been fighting in their younger years or whatever, but I don't really know why we need a bony one that sticks out, do you?
No, or if you know, the bone in it is quite thin and brittle as well. Evolution should have given us a nice thick nose bone that can take a punch.
Yeah, we probably if we'd have been fighters when we, you know, if we'd had to still fight for our food and for our women, and, you know, if like evolution hadn't have given us MacBook Pros and like all the computer stuff, so that we don't have to fend off lions and tigers anymore, then maybe we wouldn't have sticky out noses, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of years on. But let's not get into evolution on the extra.
We'll get back to barrow accidents. Man, we're talking about barrow accidents. I've never knocked myself out or broken a nose, but I do recall on a quite lengthy barrow journey a few years back. You know, it's only a day session, I'm not overloaded, so I'm in quite a rush. I decided to steer around this big bumpy route, only the wheel managed to catch another one. My barrow's at an angle. The barrow come to a abrupt halt. The end of the barrow handle went straight between my legs. Yeah, it was about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm just glad there was no one else around, because I was on my knees for about 5 minutes.
It wasn't St. Ives, was it?
No, it wasn't, no. It was a dark park.
Do you remember the Travelator on St. Ives?
Oh, God, yeah. It was, did you ever make it, or did you just give up like the rest of us and load your barrow at the top?
excuse me. Yeah, I think I used to load it at the top. So for people that don't know, it was basically a hill that then it was like a dirt hill that had been made from some like excavation at the side. I think they were digging stuff at the back or whatever it was, but it was a hill out the car park, and then it ran like flat, quite high for, I don't know, 100 yards or something, and then it came back down again on like a steep kind of 45 degree slope. So even if you loaded your barrow at the top of it, then pushed it along, like you still had a decision of what to do when you came back down, didn't you? Like you could just kind of dig your heels in, like lean back and hold on to the barrow and let it pull you down, and you're just trying to like apply brakes. But it got some speed up, didn't it?
Oh yeah, right. Was it as bad as the slope on pit two?
Yeah, that was different though, because like it was only ever one way, wasn't it?
I'd say the slope was worse because it was clay. Slightest bit of moisture, and that's it. You just held on and tried to stay upright.
Yeah, the slope was so long that like you would normally carry your gear up or down it, wouldn't you? You'd like to attempt it. You normally couldn't. You hadn't got a barrow that far around anyway, had you? Like you couldn't really get a barrow along the first bank past the Sunken Islands. I used to barrow around there? I can't remember. I think I used to walk most of my gear to the pegs on there anyway.
Yeah, you got your barrow nicked on pit two, didn't you?
Oh, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I did. Left it at the top. I think it was a malicious nicking as well, not somebody that wanted a barrow. I think it was somebody wanted me not to have a barrow as opposed to they wanted the barrow. I'm not sure. Never quite sure. But that's pretty much bringing this Carpcast Extra to a close. We hope you've enjoyed the stories. We've still got plenty more left for next time. Is there anything else you want to add, Mark? Anything else you want to make me squeamish with?
No, but I might send you some squeamish links.
No, I can't. Somebody posted a fishing injury, because we were talking about injuries a little while back. Somebody posted that one. Oh, the only picture that stood out was like a collage of pictures, but one of them was like some big sea treble type thing stuck through the heel of somebody's foot.
Oh, I saw that one. That did look painful.
I've still not looked at those pictures. Every time it flashes on Facebook, I scroll past it really quick.
Go and look. Yeah. You've not seen the hook in the eye?
No,
in the eye,
no.
The eyeball.
Stop. I feel sick. I actually feel sick. That's the end of this, so I've got to go.
Alright, so thanks again everyone for subscribing, and we'll see you next month for more.
See you next month. Turn on to me.
Turn up.